Steve, thanks. A little bit of a late start for us today. As you heard,
I could have slept in.
You could have slept in a little bit.
Then you would have
more.
Missed that very important news. Is that what you wanted to do? Is that what you want?
I don't even understand this news because.
Well, here's where it gets tricky. And Steve, you mentioned this beautifully. You just said he, being Merrick Garland, the nominee for the Supreme Court, has an uphill battle, and he certainly does. And one of the main reasons you also illustrated is that the Republicans have said they refuse to meet with the man, which
well,
is necessary.
Yeah, well, we'll see if that holds. I mean,
but I don't understand any of this.
Okay, so, you know, the president names nominees to the Supreme Court. Well, it's very important. It's a big plum. It lasts forever. Antonin Scalia was on the court for 30 years, so he dies unexpectedly. And now the Republicans are thinking, damn, Obama's got 1 year left. We could have a Republican president, and we're losing this choice. Instead of a Republican getting to choose Scalia's replacement, it's going to Obama in the last year in office.
But can I point something out very quickly for just a second, and we'll go back to your explanation? Is that if it's a Republican in office, more than likely it will be Donald Trump, the man that most of the Republican Party is rebelling against.
Well, that's a hitch in the giddy-up.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I understand that, Steve. It's just, you know, he is the president for a little while yet. So
January.
Well, so he has the right to do this.
Well, of course
whole
he does. It's a
crazy government. I'm for Trump now.
It's a political argument, a completely political argument that, you know, and the Republicans will point out that Joe Biden made a similar political argument, I think, in 1988. Now, in that case, there wasn't an actual nomination on their docket. There is now.
Right.
So the president nominates this man who's 63, which I think is interesting, too, because it might be a little bit of a nod toward compromise. This isn't a guy
Absolutely.
Who's going to be on the bench for 40 years.
Right.
So we will see now if.
Steve,
you know,
don't tell him that part, though. Don't explain to Merrick Garland.
You only got a few years left in you.
One of the reasons we like you so much is you're a little older.
He knows he won't be there for 40 years.
Was he crying or is he hoarse or was it both?
He's very emotional.
Yeah, I also think he just had a voice thing. I don't think it was all together. I think it was a mixture. But, so we'll see now, though, because there will be real pressure. I mean, the president referred to polls that show like 60% of Americans think that the president, you know, deserves to have his nominee voted on.
Right.
It's a very bizarre thing. And, you know, the Republicans are quick to say, well, this never happens. You know, we haven't had this happen in 80 years or whatever. That's because justices don't usually die in office.
Right.
They usually retire. And when they retire, they don't often retire in the last year of a presidency. So it's just unusual that it would happen. It's even more unusual that a justice would not only die in office, but die in the last year of a presidency.
Well,
but has happened. And
but that's a that's Antonin Scalia's poor fortune. There's nothing that can be done about
you
that.
You can blame him.
He's not trying to die. He didn't want to die. It wasn't his goal to die and mess up the machine. But don't you think they owe this guy, and I don't know that much about him other than what we've just heard, but don't you think they at least owe him the courtesy of sitting down and having this meeting that you're supposed to have with him? Doesn't that make sense?
Well, it's just an odd thing. I mean, you know, and Mitch McConnell said, truly, I mean, the news of Scalia's death hadn't been an hour or two old when he said, we won't even consider someone.
Isn't that, that's insane.
Well, it doesn't, I mean, to me, it seems like you would have served better to go through the motions
right.
and then vote him down.
Right.
You know, if you don't want the Obama to be able to name a justice, okay, you've got the votes. Don't vote for one. But it kind of, I don't quite understand. I think they put themselves in a box here by saying we won't even consider it because it makes them look like the bad guys. Had they just said, oh, sure, we'll look at the person and then said we looked at him, we don't like him.
Right.
That's a little more defensible.
I am beside myself with dilemma because the Republicans aren't going to talk to Barack Obama's Supreme Court justice nominee. If Donald Trump is going to be running for president, they may change the plan. I mean, do they get to just make things up as they go along?
Well, no, but there's two possible things that could happen. There's only two scenarios. Scenario number one is that a Democrat is our next president, either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, to which case they're right back where they are right now.
Yep.
It's all right. And then the other one is a Republican, more than likely Donald Trump. And that's the guy that everybody from Mitt Romney to John McCain is saying, this is not the best
choice.
So just
take this guy.
That'd be too easy.
So if they don't approve or speak to this gentleman, Mr. Garland, they are just buying their time till after the election. That does not,
exactly.
That is not right.
10 months.
You guys, that is not right.
Well, we'll see. You know, they're not doing anything illegal. They're not doing anything that they don't have the, you know, authority.
But Steve, isn't this, this is the seed by which everything is wrong, is
that
so many
point.
People in politics, just by virtue of the fact that somebody is Democrat or Republican, it just says, nah, I'm not going to talk to the guy.
Do away with the parties. That's it. I'm done. I swear to God, I'm going independent.
Well, but see, this is the issue then. So if enough people react the way you two did and create this outcry, it doesn't serve the Republicans well to not consider it. And that's why I just don't understand why McConnell put them in such a box by declaring this position.
Right.
So, you know, it's going to be a long summer, and we'll see that there may well be, you know, Senator Kirk, who is running here in Illinois and is vulnerable, frankly. It's a blue state. He's a Republican senator. He's going to be running now against Tammy Duckworth. It's not going to serve the Republicans who want to keep control of the Senate to hang guys like Kirk out, you know, by angering so many voters.
Right, right.
So it's a guy like Kirk or Kelly Ayotte in the Northeast who can suffer from this. So, you know, there's always time for movement. We could see what happens. There might be a change.
That would be nice. That would be refreshing and nice.
What is happening to the Grand Ole Party?
It's not even just... It isn't just...
Is it a good old party now?
No. But it's not just the Republican side by a long shot. It's just the way the game is played now. It's just people just so sticking to the party lines, and it's to the detriment of the country. I mean, the Supreme Court is there for a reason. It's not just you know, pretend.
Well, and the Supreme Court's work doesn't end. That's the other thing.
Right.
So they're hearing cases right now with 8 justices, and what that means is that if they come out of that tide, the lower court is automatically affirmed, the lower court ruling.
Yes.
So it's not like they're saying, okay, we're going to put these cases off until we get the ninth judge.
It continues.
Not. Justice, I should say. Right.
You're right, Bill. It's not just the Republicans, because when I voted yesterday and I got my little sticker, I don't know why that's so exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even want to put it on because I want to save it for what? I don't know.
The I voted sticker?
But the Democratic parties had some issues, too, because they misspelled the circuit court judge's name.
Oh,
and
they
so
did.
They had to give you a handout. And just, you know, you finally make it to a ballot.
Mom,
and they mess up your name.
Yeah.
I know.
So here's my favorite part of voting yesterday. I waited in line for the first time, I think, in my life.
Really?
Yeah. And they ran out of the I voted today stickers in English.
So what did you guess?
So in this era of Donald Trump, they were handing out stickers in Spanish. Saying,
well, how
I voted
do you say
today.
I voted in Espanol?
Well, I don't know. I don't remember.
Sure.
But they ran out of the English ones, and I just thought that was kind of funny.
It's very funny.
That is great.
We're going to build a wall out of those stickers later.
All right. We have so much to tell you today, and we want your participation at 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. It's Bill Leff and it's Wendy Snyder talking about a couple of things. Certainly yesterday's election and also President Obama's speech introducing Merrick Garland, his nominee for the Supreme Court. Wendy, I know you have a story about voting yesterday, but there are people who want to chime in as to what we were just discussing. 312-981-7200. Let's take a call or two real quick.
All right. Dave's on the line. Hey, Dave.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Morning.
Two things. One, Kim Fox this morning said something to Steve in regards to her taking over the party in the state's attorney, where she said it's about the office. It is not about the individual. Well, we all know it's about the individual when it comes to Trump. Secondly.
And Anita Alvarez, because, you know, the people spoke about that. So it is kind of the individual.
Well, that's the sad part about it, but it should be about the office. We're looking at somebody who's going to be the caretaker of the office of the President of the United States and the people as well.
That's
secondly,
right.
If the Republicans go to a brokered convention, keep in mind that all of the candidates that have run under the primaries, they are not and will not be allowed to go back in and run under a third party, as a third party. It would have to be an individual that comes up through the ranks that was never on the ticket. So, therefore, who are we looking at? Ryan, who has already been approached.
Yep. Interesting.
So it would be the third party.
Did you vote yesterday?
Pardon me?
Did you vote yesterday?
I'm in Indiana. We don't vote until May, and I know where my vote's going, and it's certainly not going to be for Trump.
All right. Well, vote in May, and thank you for calling, Dave. We appreciate it.
Yeah, get off.
Thanks, Dave.
Hey, Donna.
Hi. Good morning, you guys. I wanted to just comment about what you were saying earlier, Wendy and Bill, both to your point about the parties and how detached they both are to what really was going on out here, how frustrated people are, including in our own Illinois legislature. It makes me absolutely nuts. I did vote. I voted for Kasich, but I do think I understand why Trump is winning, and that is because the media has become so sensationalistic. Everything they do is a five-second soundbite, and if it doesn't fit in those 5 seconds, it doesn't make the news. So there's no no girth to what they bring to the table. And so now you're left with a bunch of people that are very mad because they're not getting information. People are aggravated. And so Trump is saying what everybody wants to hear, and he's absolutely right about what he said. But beyond that, he, I do think, would cause World War III. So the fact of the matter is that until somebody can come to the table and offer some sense of realism to what is actually happening here and stop playing politics, this is going to be a disaster. And I don't know how around you can get around this. I'm going to tell the media, would you please put the facts out there instead of talking about Trump all the time?
Donna, I know what you say. I understand what you say about the sound bites, and everybody's attention span is geared that way. But I know for myself, and I know for a lot of other people that I associate with, we watch the debates from start to finish. We watch the town hall meetings from start to finish. We're getting more than just a 5 or 6 second clip. And the situation is dire. It really, really is in all directions. I mean, I was talking about party affiliation and how upsetting it can be. I watched the debate where at the end of the debate, the last question was, even though you guys don't get along and see eye to eye, will you still support whoever wins on the Republican side? And these guys who just seemed to bash Trump and bash Trump and bash Trump said, yeah, if he gets it, if the party wants him, then I'm on their side. I don't think it should be that way. I would be the first guy to support somebody who'd say, that guy right there, the guy I don't agree with on anything, no way would I support him. Why can't that happen?
Right. Agreed. I completely agree. That's why everybody is so, they're such hypocrites.
Yes.
And Trump represents the opposite because he doesn't play. He usually he's not a hypocrite. Typically, that's not always coming across. I don't know all of the ins and outs of all of his background. But again, it's all about being a hypocrite and how people cannot stand it. And when you're out here in middle America and you're dealing with a bunch of hypocrites all the time in your jobs or whatever the situation, we've had it. We're mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore. And I think that's why Trump is winning.
Yeah, you're
onto
something.
Donna.
Thanks.
Really appreciate your call. We'll talk more about this today. Later on, we're going to talk to the Tribune's Kristen McQuarrie. A little recap of the Illinois primary. Walter Jacobson will be in later on this afternoon. I almost didn't get to vote. And I left here yesterday at 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
I couldn't wait to get to the poll and cast my vote. I basically do it for the sticker.
You just wanted the sticker.
Steve pointed out that they ran out of the ones that said I voted, so they went to the Spanish ones. Would it be El Voto? Is that what the other ones said?
I'm not sure. Maybe.
I wanted that one, too. So I had to do some last minute.
I'm told by David Miranda here, it's Yavote.
Yavote, yeah. That's I voted. El Voto is Zorro's cousin, I believe. I think he is.
So I had to go get some stuff, last minute stuff for Michael's Ireland trip because he's leaving today. And so I'm at Marshall's and TJ Maxx, and then he had a concert. So I texted him and I said, you know, can I come to this? I don't know. Then 2 seconds later, sure, you can come. So I'm trying to get there, and I realize it's 5 to 7 and I haven't voted yet, and the polls close at 7.
Yeah.
So I freaked out, got to my polling place, walked in at 2 minutes to 7.
Yeah.
And I'm like running to the door.
Uh-huh.
And I get in, and I was in a panic because once you're in, you're in. I didn't know that. I just know that there were people outside going, 1 minute till 7, polls close in 1 minute. And I'm inside with my ballot going, oh my God, do I have to finish this by 7 o'clock? Or since I'm in, no one's explaining it to me.
Like put ACT your pencils test. Down, please. Pencils down.
Don't look at your neighbor's paper.
And then it's like a marker, and you're just supposed to draw a line, and then right. I filled it in, and I said, will it count? And the judge goes, I don't know, we'll see when you put it in the big machine. And it did work, but I was so nerve-wracked, and they...
But it counted? You got in time?
They closed the polls. They did not rush us. Oh. And we finished our polling. I did finish by 7 o'clock,
all
by
right.
the way, because
well,
I panicked.
Success. No reason to panic.
I just
it's
got
right.
my sticker. That's all I wanted. I don't care about the country. I want my sticker.
That's all.
You know what was exciting to me? Huh. A girl's first election she voted in. I was there, and she was 17 and a half. She will be 18 yeah. for the general election. So it was very exciting for her.
Oh,
she,
sure.
She went in the little kiosk next to her mom because she had a few questions, and it was really an adorable moment.
Yeah. Yeah. That first time, it gives you a rush every time, but that first time in particular when you realize, you know, there's a lot of history behind
yeah.
this. Sure.
So we're walking sense. Out, and I said, is this your first one? And she goes, yes, I'm so excited. And I'm like, congratulations. She said, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And she just like skipped down the street to walk home. It was really cool seeing that.
I mean, like when adults skip. That's she's always fun to watch.
Well, 17. She's not an adult yet.
Well, if she's old enough to vote, she's old enough to skip, I guess. Let's take a quick break. A whole lot coming up next. Stick around. Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thanks so much. It's Bill Leffin. It's Wendy Snyder. You know Dane Neal from his segments here on Flavor HD. Today, Dane is bringing a combination of two of our favorite things, food and film. Hello, Dane.
It's good to see you guys. Yeah, and if you're going to like two things, those are two things. Number one, that we need.
Yes.
And then number two, that we also need and also oftentimes enjoy or get to mock.
So true.
This is one of those rare combinations, and there's been food films out there like, you know, Chef, you remember that with Jon Favreau came out and
yeah.
got a chance to watch that and thought it was great. Anything in the food space is kind of interesting as far as the content. Burnt, not so much.
Babette's Feast, if I can go foreign on you.
What
ever
are you
seen
saying?
That? That's a foreign film that if you like food and you like movies.
And you like wow. Babette's.
That's right.
There's nothing wrong with it.
The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and his lover is also a very good movie if you like.
if you like intrigue.
If you like intrigue.
Your food and your cinema.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
So Jonathan Gold is one of those individuals in the food world and the food media world. He is the subject of the documentary City of Gold, which is premiering this weekend here in Chicago. And he is one of those amazing kind of transcendent figures that breaks the mold of what you think of as far as a food critic. He's a mm-hmm. guy that was a rock musician, a punk rock musician. He was a guy that wrote, you know, for music. He wrote for Rolling Stone, and then was one of those guys initially that came in and loved and gave importance to food, everything from, you know, chili cheese fries all the way up to fine dining and certainly all the cultures.
He does run that gamut, doesn't he? Because I've read him a little bit, and he's everywhere.
He is his mind is so great that he knows enough to be able to move seamlessly and effortlessly through those circles, and he's a Pulitzer Prize winner. I mean, once you get that kind of writing street cred, you've got it. So he is going to be in town Friday and Saturday. The movie City of Gold is going to be happening here, and he's going to be here doing Q&A. And so I brought in Louisa Chu. You know her. She is a successful and prolific radio personality on the food side, and also one of our own Chicago Tribune food writers and co-Bacon Fest judge.
That's right.
And that
Dane
was great.
And I survived, Bacon Fest judging together.
Can I tell you that means more than anything else that all your other credentials?
As it should.
And it's Louisa Chu. So she's going to get to sit there being a writing food mind herself, break it down for the audience and for the listeners in the Q&A. It's going to be
nice.
Great.
Nice. Hi, Louisa. Thanks for being
Hi,
here.
Bill. Thanks for having me.
Tell a little bit about Jonathan Gold. Now, you've met him in the past. You know of him.
You know what? I have not met Jonathan in person yet. I have been following his work, like Dane, for decades now. I lived in L.A. for 7 years and read some of his early stuff, you know, when he was first starting out, and like the famous work that he did the year he ate Pico Boulevard. And Pico is kind of like our Western or Lincoln. I mean, just like a whole big mashup of all different kinds of food. And this is when he was like a sad copywriter and just like wanted to find some meaning in life. And so he stopped at like every single little dive and just kind of wrote about it for himself, you know, before it was ever published. So a lot of times when I try to explain, like, what's the big deal with this Pulitzer Prize winning food critic, restaurant critic for the LA Times, I say, because really at the heart of it, he's one of us. He's like the kind of guy who just like drives around trying to find like the best taco because it might be gone, you know? And so he puts on the miles and serious about it.
That's a nice little story of how he got his start. He was like the everyman and just kind of started going, because we all do that. We all look for some unique place to try.
Yeah.
And it's not like he's, you know, the Mr. Blackwell of food. He's just, you know, he just came into it naturally.
Totally.
But interesting.
I mean, certainly he has covered some of the really big fancy restaurants. I mean, he was writing for Gourmet Magazine, which I covered for Chicago too, but before it went away. And so he went to, you know, I mean, fancy restaurants like Alinea and El Bulli in Spain. I mean, but at his heart, the places that he's best known for are like the food carts and the taco trucks and the dives and the people behind them.
You could make the comparison fairly easily that he is to food and food criticism, that Roger Ebert was to film and film criticism. And the Pulitzer Prize makes it even easier to make that comparison, right?
Here's the thing that is so special is that he brings you in, and the writing style isn't just a critique of what is necessarily on the plate. And so many kind of food critics fall into that category. They're supporting things and kind of breaking it down for you. But a lot of time it's punitive in the way, in the things that they say. And it isn't written in a way that everybody can kind of enjoy and say, like, hey, this is something that I'd like to see. David Chang had said in the movie that one of the things that makes him so great is that he has, other than the other thing,
right,
that
you're profane.
Right. Don't share the great places because then they're too crowded for me.
Right.
But he said he has a very unique way and an empathy where he takes in everything that's going on into the restaurant, whether it's the culture, the people, the work, the area, and adds that into what it is he's talking about, as opposed to just being kind of punitive if it isn't, you know, exactly perfect on the plate.
Yeah.
So how did the City of Gold happen? I mean, just somebody said this what is such a unique story. Let's tell it.
I don't know. I mean, and that's a great question for Louisa, because it is one of those things. I mean, there's everybody eats, right? And so you'd think this is something people can relate to. Let's make a movie about food. I guess the topic is so different, but here's one of the upsides of it is that LA is a city that when you think of it, just like when you think of, you know, Panama, you think of like, you know, genocidal dictators or something, right?
Right.
Even if that's not what's going on right now.
Right.
I'm just kidding. But in LA, you think, what do you think? You think Hollywood, you think maybe riots, maybe you just think sprawling neighborhoods.
Yeah. I don't think food.
But you don't think food, you know, and he's,
I think healthy. I think, you know, lots of kale shakes and stuff like that.
Well, there's definitely that too. I mean, but, you know, the way that this came around was that the director, Laura Gabbert, actually started working on this like a long time ago. I want to say at this point now, maybe a decade ago, and was shooting him for years. Actually, even before he joined the LA Times as restaurant critic, he had to tell his editors, hey, this has been in the works. I don't think it's going to get shown. And the director said, you know, no, it's going to get shown. And so much so that in the film, you see his young family, his son and his daughter. And I actually had a chance to interview Jonathan for a story that's coming out in the Trib later this week. And he actually not only has an old family connection here in Chicago, all the way back to his grandmother, who sold flowers at the old Ambassador East Hotel. Both of his parents were here. But this film was made so long ago that now his daughter is a senior at the University of Chicago.
Oh my God.
So he's here all the time eating.
How about that?
Yeah.
How about that? They show at the very beginning of the film, and I don't even need to say spoiler alert because it happens in the first few minutes. They show him, I guess he frequents kind of a food truck place called Gorilla Tacos, and you just see the passion and the excitement of having these tacos, you know? I love that.
Well, and Louisa kind of mentioned it, too, is one of the things that he did, not only is the street food scene, but the diverse cultures in Los Angeles, certainly Chicago, we have, you know, so much of that going on as well. But he gives, like, weight to things that would be thought of on the food side as pedestrian, right? I remember Koji Barbecue being and interviewing him at Aspen when he was one of the best new chefs, and Jonathan Gold was a big part of making that food, that kind of food, recognized as like just as important as some of the other stuff.
And so, of course, that's the taco truck that was really sort of credited for this whole chef-driven taco or food truck craze, where they blended Korean and Mexican foods in, you know, like, for example, the kimchi quesadilla was like the famous dish there.
Right.
And he was really the guy who really kind of understood how important and a big deal that was.
Well, he explained in the film, at the very beginning of the film, I think there's a preconceived notion if you're going to a food truck that maybe the guys doing the cooking aren't that well schooled, maybe in culinary arts. But they say that the chief chef studied in France and Paris, and that's where he learned his craft. And they show the various ingredients that go in there, and they're not skimping. It's really it's like restaurant quality, even though it's a food truck.
Well, and here's what that does: is not only does it give it the credibility it deserves, but it supports it as a business, and then it also inspires like other chefs to say like, "Hey, this is okay." I kind of liken it to the, you know, on the television side. You know, there really isn't a line between, "Hey, this is lesser than," on the TV side. You know, if you're doing a series on Netflix and it is really really good,
yeah,
it's just as Emmy worthy as any or Oscar worthy sure. as anything else, and that's the way it was with the food side.
Yep.
I love the movie Chef with Jon Favreau. That is like the greatest, cutest little movie ever.
Isn't that fun?
I really
it's a
do.
Great movie.
But if we want to see City of Gold, fresh from its appearance at the Sundance, a documentary, Friday and Saturday, how do we do it? What's the website? What's the best way to do the Q&A with Louisa Chu and Jonathan Gold?
Well, the tickets are at the Landmark website, Fandango, Movie Phone, etc., or at the Landmark Theater box office. It's Friday and Saturday. After the 7:15 show, so they're going to show the movie, and then I guess Louisa, you're going to be doing the.
I'll be there Saturday night doing the Q&A. So it opens this Friday, but it's going to be hopefully playing for a little while longer. But he'll be doing the Q&A on Friday and Saturday night, and I'll be joining him after the showing on Saturday.
Website again?
It's the Fandango site. Rob, what is the website? The Fandango site, Movie Phone,
and
the.
LandmarkTheaters.com is your best bet. A little bit more about food and food criticism with us, Bill and Wendy. We've got Louisa Chu here. We've got Dane Neal here. Stick around. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's WGN. Dane Neal is here. You know him from his work with Flavor HD. Louisa Chu is here talking about moderating a Q&A with Jonathan Gold, the food critic who is featured in the film City of Gold. We'll give you more about the documentary in just a little bit. Here's a quick question, though. If you're a critic of, let's say, film, there are secrets that you can't give away when you're writing your review. That's just the way it's structured. With food criticism, are there secrets that you can't or don't want to give away?
I don't know. I mean, I think that there's certain maybe surprises now to certain menus, you know, I mean, especially with more of like the modernist cuisine where it's like if something is made where like, say, for example, if you had there was, for example, like one famous dish that was served at the restaurant El Bulli in Spain, which was considered one of the best restaurants in the world. And I actually had a chance to stage there one summer, do an apprenticeship there.
Yeah. Nice.
And
you had a chance to what?
Do a stage or an apprenticeship there.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was a foreign word to me, and I didn't understand it.
Where you get in and work for a bit and kind of experience it. It's really cool.
Yeah. It's a French from the French to stage or to stagiaire. Yeah. Yeah. So apprentice, work for free. sounds so much better.
It sounds less, yeah. Stage is better.
Yes. And so there was actually one dish that was inspired by a dish that came from the late Moto restaurant, and it was a white chocolate balloon, a bubble.
Yeah.
And so something, you know, was cracked open. So it was kind of, it was called like a dinosaur egg.
Yeah.
And so variations of that sort of dish have come out now where it's like, say, chocolate is poured over and it melts or, yeah. you know, like melts into petals. And so, you know, I'm like, maybe something like that is considered sort of like a surprise or a spoiler alert.
I don't know. I hear chocolate balloon. I go to that restaurant. I don't want a surprise. I want to know I'm getting a chocolate balloon.
I think you put it right on the marquee or the menu, home of the chocolate
right.
balloon.
Right. On your attraction board.
They would not have closed. Yeah.
Wow, does that sound good? It really does.
Well, Bill, you mentioned kind of that connection or some of the similarities between, and I think that they're every bit valid of like a Roger Ebert and then you've got a Jonathan Gold, and you know, where almost their opinion becomes like bigger than the other people in the industry. And I think it's because there's a trust level, right? You can't go and see every movie. You can't go to every restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so you want somebody out there that's going to, you know, give you their opinion. You feel that it's valid. And as far as normally the, you know, the food critics out there, and of course, you know, Pat Bruno for so many years here in Phil Vitale, they're like, you know, there's this anonymity, right? They're supposed to be secretly going there and they're not supposed to, the restaurants aren't supposed to know that they're here. But with social media now, and then I think the value of having, you know, some celebrity in that industry for trying to share what it is your opinion and your stories and your brand, you know, whatever that is, I don't think he can do it anymore. And that's, he kind of tackles that in the movie as well. You know, whether he makes the reservations under different names, uses different numbers. He doesn't announce that he's coming.
Right.
So it's kind of almost he like surprises them.
Yeah.
But they know he's there, you know, when he gets there.
With movie reviews, there's places like Rotten Tomatoes where any filmgoer can post a review. And that, to some extent, is the case with Yelp, with food reviews. How do your major food critics view something like Yelp, where everybody has a say in whether or not a restaurant is good or food is good?
I think it really varies. I just recently read another interview that Jonathan Gold gave where he said that, you know, Yelp is fine. And I mean, I think that for certain things like logistics, it's actually really pretty good. I mean, like simple name, address, you know, website link. Mm-hmm. But the problem comes in when people make write so-called reviews. I've never visited this restaurant, but I'm going to give it a one-star review, and here's why. Oh, that's thanks. That really helps, you know? And I mean, I feel so sorry, for example, for some of my friends who own restaurants. And I mean, there are some who are not tech savvy, internet savvy. Thank goodness they never read those reviews.
Yeah.
But
some are just completely a personal vendetta against somebody, though, too. So
absolutely.
When you read the reviews, and they definitely can come in handy, look and see what it's about. If it's like, I've never been treated so poorly, you know, maybe that's true. But just take it all with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
If it's specific problems, don't you owe it to the restaurateur to say, here's an issue I had, and then hopefully they'll rectify it?
One might think, you know, I mean, but I think we've all been there. I recently had an experience like that where I had visited a restaurant and was somehow charged for my party of 10, 33% gratuity.
Oh,
and
That's generous.
You're so generous.
Wow. And I really tried hard to contact the restaurant, and it took a while. And so I could see why people might resort to, say, Yelp and write their so-called review, which is, you know, I mean, which is valid. And Gold is okay with that. I mean, it serves its place for some things. But restaurant criticism, certainly at his level, is a different thing. I mean, it's certainly written from a perspective and experience that is really pretty unparalleled.
During the film, you get an opportunity to see him kind of working, and he understands the importance not only of what it is he does and
sure.
the impact it'll have on those restaurants, but also on kind of sharing those stories of the city that he lives in, you know, and why it's important to LA, why it's important to help kind of define it as a great food city that is kind of, I think, unknown in the popular culture. And then Louise is going to do the Q&A afterwards. Well, they've been generous enough. We have two tickets that we can give away for the film, probably either Friday or Saturday, whatever works for people over at Landmark Theaters.
Let's do caller number 8, because that's the past tense of the word eat, and it all makes sense. Give us a call right now, 312-981-7200. Be caller number 8, and you will win the tickets that Dane just spoke of. This sounds like a good time. It really does. City of Gold is the name of the documentary. It's coming up. Give all the information, Dane. We don't leave anything out.
It's got landmarktheaters.com/Chicago. You can get tickets. You can also go to MoviePhone or Fandango and get them as well. It's coming up Friday and Saturday night. And of course, you know, we'll have a ticket, two tickets for somebody who's listening today.
Very good. We'll announce who that is in just a little bit, Louisa.
If I can also mention that the Chicago Tribune has an event coming up where you can play critic yourself. It's our mac and cheese event that's coming up. Yeah,
I love mac and
which
cheese.
Which is great.
I want to bathe in it.
Close the show with that and see what happens.
You can look for tickets at chicagotribune.com, mac and cheese, and there's going to be two chefs facing off making mac and cheese, and you can play critic there.
It's so nice to see you again, Louisa. Dane, I saw you recently, but Louisa, we worked in radio together at The Loop, and I haven't seen you in how many years?
When we were children, I think. I think we needed to have our parents drive us in.
Nice to see you again.
Nice seeing you.
Thanks,
guys. And then I'll be on Friday overnight, and then on Sunday, 1 till 3 as well.
Perfect. Congrats. Great to see both of you. We'll take a quick break, and then a lot more show coming your way next. Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Great job, Kim. Thank you very much. I am a trivia freak. Can I tell you that?
Sure.
But my trivia expertise is different than yours.
How so? How do you think?
Well, IMDb was named after, it was for you, Internet Movie Data Bill.
Yes.
So movies and television shows, that is your specialty.
Yeah.
I like just weird stuff.
Just fun facts that nobody should retain, but you do somehow?
Yeah, but a lot of science-related things, a lot of interesting things, and we're going to find out 100 things to know before we grow up, and we better hurry because we got to get 100 things in before the show ends.
Yes.
Becky Bain's on the line with us once again, writer and editor at National Geographic Children's Books, and I hope you're ready to quiz us, Becky.
Yes, I can be ready at any moment.
Becky, we would like cash and prizes for whoever wins. Are you prepared to provide cash and prizes?
you know, I have so much cash, I don't know what to do with it.
Don't we all?
I will send some your way.
All right, perfect.
All right, so tips, tricks, and skills that every kid should know and master before turning 18. I don't know if this is in the book because I didn't have time to look through all 100 of them, but would sewing a button on be one of those? Because that's what I taught my sons how to do.
You know, sewing a button, this is the third book in the series, and the first book was 100 Things to Do Before You Grow Up, which was mostly activities, but sewing a button was in that one.
All right, good.
I probably do it. And I didn't know there was a proper way. So I guess now we do.
Really, the only proper way is don't prick your finger with the needle.
Oh.
That's really all you have to know.
To be fair, I can't do it. I know I can't do it. I've never done it. I mean, I think if there was an emergency situation, I'd probably learn how fast, but I've never sewn anything on anything.
You know, one thing I learned in doing this book is you're never too old.
All right.
You know, none of us are really grown up, so there's always time.
All right. How about this one? How to tie-dye a shirt. Have you ever done that?
No.
Oh, my God. We had so much fun doing that when we were growing up, where you just put rubber bands on a T-shirt. Becky, maybe you can talk about this a little more.
Yeah. So this is one of the fun ones in the book. We definitely have some that are like skill building that your parents would really want you to know. But then we have some that are just for fun. And I think tie-dyeing a T-shirt is that quintessential kid experience, and everyone needs to do it. But you are totally right. The key is knowing the proper way to roll it and then putting the rubber bands on it before you dip it in the dye. And we have step-by-step instructions in the book.
Wendy, you used to have sleepovers at Janis Joplin's house, so I'm guessing that was the sort of thing you guys would do quite often, right?
Actually, we did it. The sleepovers were with the Dead when I did the
tie-dye.
Oh,
really? The Grateful Dead?
Janis's parties were a little different.
Oh, I bet.
A little different. Some other things. What are some of your favorites in this book? Because here's how to journal like a pro. I don't know how to journal. I'm going to read this. I'm above 18.
Yeah, there are so many in here that I really love. I mean, I really like the aspirational ones that kind of, you know, turn well-rounded kids into well-rounded adults, like how to be an adventurous eater. I will eat anything and everything, so I love adventurous eaters. You know, how to speak your mind, that's a good one. How to be grateful. There are so many in here that, you know, even some adults I know don't necessarily do this on a regular basis, so it's a great lesson for anyone who wants to flip through it and learn what they can maybe do to improve upon what they've been doing.
All right, there's one in here that I think should be filed under duh.
What is that one? Which is it?
And please, Becky, tell me that kids under 18 know how to do this. How to check out books at your local library. Seriously, people have trouble with this?
You would be surprised. You know, kids know what they've experienced. And unfortunately, some kids have not been to the library. And hopefully it's something they are doing in school. But yeah, you do need to know once you get there how you go about getting a library card and what you do with it from there. So that is one of the easier ones. But I will tell you, there are some kids who can't do it.
That's sad.
This is one that caught my eye, and I'll explain why in a little bit. It's how to wrap a present. In my case, and I know this will sound awful, but you can tell how much I love and care about the person by how much time I've spent wrapping their gift. If I really love you, if you're a family member or a friend that I really love, it will look like it's professional quality. But if I don't care that much for you, you'll just go, but wait, there's barely even tape on this. You just surrounded my present with wrapping paper. You didn't even do anything to secure it.
Becky, because having you on, I now know that you must care a lot about me because I was amazed at your wrapping job.
I can wrap when I want to. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, anything is better than throwing it in a bag, like a plastic grocery bag. I've received presents like that before. Probably means they don't care about me a whole lot.
That's sad.
You can make anyone feel loved and cared for. Wrapping a present the proper way is not difficult, and we walk you through it step by step. And even if you don't have wrapping paper, we have some ideas of what you could use instead.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you never have to make someone feel lousy when they stick it in a grocery bag.
Right. Now, here's one. This is a double-edged sword. I think most people will find one of these way easier than the other. One of them is how to be a gracious winner, which is really easy. You just thank the person for showing up and go about your business. The other one, very difficult, how to be a gracious loser. That one's a lot
harder.
That's hard. Yeah.
You know, you would be surprised. There are some, you know, in public platforms everywhere right now, there are some people that I wouldn't necessarily call gracious winners. And it's something I think a lot of adults can take to heart as well. I mean, part of being a gracious winner is acting humble, you know, appreciating the other person, you know, complimenting them on their efforts, and you're right, going about your business. That's really difficult for some people. Some people just have this need to kind of gloat. So that is a little bit tricky, but being a gracious loser is definitely the trickier one. That one's more about sucking up your pride, and if you're emotional about it, hide in a closet or something.
You know, when this came into play last night, Becky, I was thinking about this last night when Marco Rubio pulled out and he admitted that this wasn't going to happen for him. And they cut to Donald Trump a little while later, who then thanked him for running a great campaign and stuff. And I thought, this has got to be eating Donald Trump alive to be saying something kind about a competitor. That's not his way.
Yeah, you know, it's really hard. It's depending on, you know, your nature as a person. It's harder for some people than others. But yeah, it's about kind of stepping outside yourself, putting yourself in that person's shoes, and thinking about how you would feel if the shoe were on the other foot and acting accordingly.
All right, I found one that is going to help us all. How to impress at a party. 5 tips to remember. Before you arrive, think of a few cool things you can talk to anyone about, such as a new pet, a recent trip, or a school project you're working on. Then when meeting people for the first time, smile and introduce yourself. I'm telling you, that is some valuable advice.
You'd think everyone would know that, but everybody doesn't seem to know that.
No, I think we've all probably met some party duds, but, you know, as you get older for kids, it's like you, most of the time when you go to a party, you're surrounded by, you know, your friends that you are comfortable with already, so it's not much of a problem. But as you get older and you're having to go to work-related parties or a party with your spouse or significant other where you don't necessarily know people, you don't want to give a bad impression. And so those are some great tips for us. You know, just making people think that you're this awesome human that they want to be around.
Sure.
Typically, I like to say that these little National Geographic kids books make very good stocking stuffers, but this is a particularly good one for summer break. Give this to your kid for a little after-school present. Not a stocking stuffer, but a summer stuffer, if you will. It is called 100 Things to Know Before You Grow Up. It is skills and tricks and tips that every kid should master before they turn 18. The ultimate guide to becoming a fun-loving, well-rounded, and totally competent and confident young person. Becky Baines, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
NationalGeographic.com or where better books are sold?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know where the best place to get it was.
That's wherever books are sold, you're sure to find it.
That's awesome. One of the chapters is how to tell somebody how to find your book. I just found that in there, too. Thanks, Becky.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's go tie-dye now. You really right. Have never done that?
I never have.
We had to do it in school.
Didn't they used to make, I'm trying to remember who made this kit, but there was a kit, like a, you could buy this kit to go home, but you could also do it without the kit, couldn't you? It's just
a white T-shirt, a white Hanes T-shirt,
rubber bands,
Rit dye.
That's it. That's it.
It's really fun. We'll do that later, Bill.
All right. We'll have tie-dye T-shirts for everybody coming up in a little bit. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. We were just talking to Becky Baines about this book, 100 Things to Know Before You Grow Up. And some of them are obvious, but some of them are a little more obscure. Are you seeing some of them that you like?
How to make comfort food. I know you don't cook.
No.
I make really good meatballs, and my sons have asked, hey, Mom, can you show me your meatball recipe? So when I...
Yeah.
Go away, get married, I can make it for my wife and impress her.
Yes, and you will show it to them or you will not?
I will show it to them, like how to make an ice cream sundae. I don't know. I guess now there are sundae bars when you go places.
Right.
So, but how would you know that unless you did it? Mashed potatoes from scratch, pot roast, comfort food, mac and cheese.
Here's one I find interesting. It's how to come up with the perfect handshake. Now, for me, we were taught that your basic handshake, which is you extend your right hand, the other person extends your right hand, you grip each other's hand, and you move it up and down.
Firmly, though.
Firmly, yes.
Because not like
right.
A little fish wrist.
No. You want it to be a firm, strong handshake. However, the generation that has come after ours has this weird thing that I see all the time, like in the health club, where they've got their own handshakes, and it involves like a lot of juking and moving back and forth and up and down, and they know each other's move. And I always think to myself, Have they called each other in advance and said, let's do handshake number 18? How do they know?
There's too many options nowadays.
There's way too many options.
You got your, like, handshake, high five, lock. You got your fist bump. You got your basic handshake.
There's this elbow twist. There's this thing where at the end of the handshake, they rub shoulders. But it's always, it's different every time. And I always think, to coordinate that with somebody, I don't understand it.
I have to tell you that Jimmy Mack, my husband, has a unique handshake for each of the boys every morning. And it's pretty sweet to watch him do it. It's like, you know, a high five, a slap, an elbow. It's just cute.
But how did it's been practiced.
And so now it's like down to a science. So then I felt left out and I said, I want a secret handshake with you. So I was trying to do ones and they weren't really fun and no one kept to mind.
Nobody will play anymore with you?
Perhaps it's because the bump was involved, that dance.
Sometimes there's that. I watch guys do this and the coordination that it takes to do this and the choreography. And I think, what do you guys meet like 3 times a week to figure out what your next move is? Just do the basic handshake.
That's boring, Bill.
I guess.
Come on. Our president did the fist bump. Remember?
I've seen him do it. Yes. I've seen him do it a couple of times.
I like these little 100 things you need to know. How to identify at least one planet. They have an app for that now. So it makes it really easy.
It's obsolete. You don't need to know how. I can do the moon. Does that count?
can do the moon in the studio. Keep your pants on.
No, I can get 8 times out of 10. I can identify the moon up in the sky.
How about this one? How to build a campfire and how to put one out. I think that's important.
There's no way I could do that.
I'd burn the backyard down.
I know in movies and in television shows they show people rubbing sticks or sometimes a rock is involved.
Well, this isn't like a camping one. This is just how to build a campfire. If you have a lighter or something, probably wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah, that would be tricky. How to keep your balance. That one seems fairly obvious to me.
I think you either can or can't. Right. Can you teach that?
No.
Probably the most important thing in this whole book.
Yeah? Oh, number 9.
How to write a check.
Yeah.
I know it's a dying art, but there are some places that they do not have any online presence, so I have to pay monthly writing a check.
Yeah.
That is something you need to know how to do.
How did that fall so out of favor? Like, there was a time
where... Because everything's online.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, you can pay online, you can bank online, and it's very rare. There's a monthly payment I make that they do not have an online presence, so I have to write out a check every month. And when you first start, we learned this in consumer ed in high school, how to write a check. I thought that was one of the most valuable classes we've ever had in high school.
Well, it's not just how to write it, but then also how to balance a checkbook, which just seems, again, you go, well, you either subtract or you add, but there's tricks to it, obviously. A friend of mine yesterday who owed me money paid by way of check and apologized not once, not twice, but 3 times for the fact that it was a check. Not for being late on reimbursing me, but he goes, the only thing I can do is write you a check. I go, that's okay. I take checks. So as he's writing, he goes, I'm so sorry. He goes, I know this is ridiculous because now you have to go to the bank and cash it. It's okay.
You don't have to go to the bank always, though.
I know. I
take a picture of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's pretty neat.
It's awesome. But that's what makes checks easier. This just came up. My niece was graduating from high school, and I didn't want to give her cash because I thought at a party.
It could be lost or
absolutely.
Stolen.
Yeah. So I wrote a check, and my kids were busting me going, why don't you give her cash? Why not a check? And I said, because you can deposit it online by taking a picture of it. It's so easy now.
Right.
That checks are the way to go. I'm back to checks.
I love them. And the place that we order them from is so gracious now. I may be their last customer. I think I'm the only customer they have because they offer me free things. If you'll order 20 more, we'll give you a boat. And I go, well, I wouldn't mind having a boat. All right.
Don't you get your checks free from the bank?
You can, but if you want lovable characters on your checks.
Oh, my God. Look at the things in life that's important to you. Who's on your checks?
I got the cast from Everybody Loves Raymond.
Why?
Because everybody loves payments.
That's why. You wouldn't like a check with Peter Boyle's face on it? Come on.
I want to do a documentary about you.
Right.
Can I just tell you how many people would go see that?
Yeah.
You are quirky.
Thank you.
You are funny.
Thank you.
You are sensitive.
Yeah.
You are just like a whole yin and yang within yourself.
Of course I am. Yep. You just want me to show you the checks, and I'm not going to. It's not going to happen. We're going to take a break.
Show me the checks.
I'm not showing you the checks. We're going to take a break. Kim Gordon has the news, and then we have all kinds of stuff coming up in the second half, too. Stay where you are. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Thank you, Kim. Hi, it's Bill and it's Wendy, and it's the second half of our show. We're at 312-981-7200. If you'd like to join in, we would love to hear from you.
Hi, Bill.
Hi. How are you? Nice to see you.
I have a couple of observations.
What are they?
You don't get women.
Well, I don't understand women. Is that what you mean? Or women don't come to me? What do you mean by I don't get
Both.
Women? I don't get either one. No, my wife frowns upon it if women do come to me, so they don't. But I don't understand women, no.
Or
men. I don't understand anybody.
I understand everyone.
Do you? Help me then.
I just know that women are weird and strange individuals.
Right.
And you were perplexed by something that I did. Kim could probably attest to this.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Kristen Decker, WGN's Kristen Decker, who is wearing some really cute shoes. And I said, oh, my God, I love those. Where did you get those?
Mm-hmm.
She answered, they're Chuck Taylor wedges. They're so hipped up and tripped
cute.
Up. I know.
What color?
Hers, I believe, were maybe an olive green Ooh. With leather laces. They're just so cute.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw Andrea Darlis, who is wearing this really cute lime green raincoat.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, that is so cute. Where'd you get it? And she told me. And then Bill said, let me ask you a question. Why do you ask people where they purchase stuff? Are you going to go out and get it? And I said, yes, that's the whole point of asking where they got it.
But then you would have the same exact clothing as them, and you could wear them at the same time, and people would call you Twinkies. Is that what you want? Do you want people to call you Twinkies?
A, maybe. Is that such a bad thing? Two, we don't hang outside of work that much.
Right, and when you see something that looks good on somebody, you want to wear it yourself, especially if you think it'll look good on you.
Yep.
But I've heard you do it many times, and I've heard my wife do it many times. I used to hear my mom do it. I've heard many women ask that same question, where did you get it? But then they don't act on it. They don't do anything with that information. And
what's
I always,
the shopping gene? You know,
is
it's
that
just
what it
that,
is? I don't know.
I'm going to order the gym shoes today.
You are going to get the same gym shoes that she has?
Maybe a different color.
All right, so let's say Kim sees you, and you're wearing a sweater today that is black, white, and gray, and it's a fine-looking sweatshirt.
It's a hoodie.
So if Kim said, where'd you get it? Actually, I know the answer to this because I've seen you do this. You will not only say where you got it, but you will say the exact amount you paid for it.
Yes. But
that's a sense of pride, too, especially if you have a really cool item and it's a bargain.
That's it. And if you noticed, Andrea said to me, oh, Eddie Bauer, complete clearance.
Right, right. So there's some pride in the fact that you didn't just get it, but you saved money somehow in getting it. But then you won't feel bad at all that somebody else is stealing your look a little bit? That
no.
wouldn't
upset
you
Oh, I think that's
all?
The ultimate compliment.
That means you. If I say, so now I feel bad because anyone who I have said, oh, that's a cute top, if I don't ask where you've got it, where you purchased it, then that means I don't really like it.
Yes.
But that's not true. It just means it might not look good on me.
When we go out, when my wife and I go out with friends, there is so much time spent. Like, and I could pull out a timer and tell you exactly how much time will be spent with the complimenting of each other's clothes. Like, guys just don't... If you could dress like you could be the nattiest dresser of all time. You could have the greatest outfit on in the world, and a guy just won't acknowledge. Guy to guy, like I would never ask a guy where he got it, how much he paid for it. But that's a big.
That's because you're boys.
I guess.
I like your shirt. Where'd you get it?
I'm not telling you.
What about that hat? I feel like you've had your hat for a while, so I don't think you would know.
Do you buy your own clothes?
I make my own clothes. Everything I wear, I've made at home on a loom.
But if somebody came over, or let's say you were playing tennis with somebody and they said, like, oh, Bill, that's a great racket. Where'd you get that? Wouldn't you feel like a sense of pride over that?
But he wouldn't tell him.
I would make up a location. I would say, I got this at Maury Mages. And they'd go, well, they don't make Maury Mages anymore.
Maury Mages is your store for sports. More sports. Maury Mages.
Call Wendy because she knows the theme. And then when that was done, I don't know. I would prefer to not be influenced by anybody else. You know how when you go into a clothing store, the Gap is famous for this. If you're looking at something at the Gap, they come up and they say to you, this is very popular. We're selling a lot of these. Then I don't want it because that means too many people are wearing it.
No one has said that to me in my life.
You've never had that happen?
No.
I've been in so many clothing store situations where they tell their way of selling me the product is telling me how popular it is. Oh, we sell these all day long. We only have two of these left. We've sold 11 of these today. Then I go, then I don't want it because everybody else will have it. You don't feel that at all? You don't
No, I never say no because I just shop.
Yeah.
And we like to be trendy. We like to be, you know, wear what's hip.
Yeah, I guess.
What's in.
I guess so.
Mike's wife is just like you, Bill. She's not going to reveal her whereabouts of where she purchased things. Is that true, Mike?
That is absolutely true. She gets all her clothes, and I pick them out for her. She said, I have excellent taste for a man.
Wow. Okay, I don't believe you.
That's great.
I don't believe you, Mike. It's hard to shop for a woman.
I have picked out her last 40 outfits.
How about that?
She has 40 outfits?
Yep. Now, we go to this mall 70 miles away.
Yeah.
And she made me promise that I would never tell anybody where she got her clothes.
Okay, well, so I'm writing it down.
I'm going to tell all of Chicago. It's Bonworth's.
Oh, I know that store.
Bonworth's.
That's a great that's a department store. They're really nice.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah.
Bonworth's and in Angola, Indiana.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'll be going there tonight. Convenient.
No, you won't.
You know you're putting your marriage on the line, Mike, just by admitting this.
Not his real name.
Oh, is that right? Okay. All right.
She's already divorced me, so it doesn't matter anymore.
See, that's why he's saying she divorced you because you picked out her last 40 outfits. They weren't that good.
The last suit was a lawsuit.
Thank you, Mike. Have a good one. Bonworth's, I've never heard of that.
Yeah, that's a department store. They're around. We don't have them here, but they're in other places.
I've never heard of that in my life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I even asked Kevin where he gets stuff because I would like to buy it for either my kids or husband.
Mm-hmm.
And you were not hesitant to tell me where you got stuff or how much it was.
Nope.
But he's not going to run into your husband. Well, there's that. It's, you know, he's much more.
Jimmy can dress like me. I don't care if that's what you're going to suggest.
Is that what you want? Do you want your husband and your producer to dress alike?
First of all, I'm not saying anything. Notice I never ask you where you got your stuff, Bertrand.
Do you go home and say, I wish you could dress more like Kevin?
I say it every day.
Say that.
No, but there's some, it's mainly for the kids, really.
Is it?
Yeah. Oh, so I dress like a kid?
Yeah.
You totally dress like a kid. Not like a tiny baby toddler, but like a teenager.
I don't know if that's much
Kevin's
better.
Kevin's in his late 20s. That's not a good
thing.
Whoa,
easy with the L word.
All right, sorry. Kevin's in his more mature 20s.
I have a 16-year-old who dresses like he's fresh out of the 70s. So, I mean, you know, if I like something, I ask where you got it because I'd like to go get it.
Yeah, all right. I can't bring myself to do that. I don't want to dress like my friends or family.
I don't.
I'm pulling that
don't
off.
Don't worry.
I'm pulling that off.
All right, well, I mean, you asked if I'd really go out and get it. I'm going to order those Chuck Taylor high tops probably during the show.
All right, and then coordinate with her. I want you guys to wear them on the same day. I think that's the look.
This reminds me of high school. Landlubber jeans were popular
when I was
in high school.
I do remember those.
And there was a bib top jean skirt, and we all had them. It's like we had to have them, and Candy's slip-on shoes. They were a little wedge, not even a wedge. It was a high heel, but just a slip-on, and we all had to get them, and my poor mother did not make a lot of money, and she did such a great job keeping me up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
And we would call each other and say, oh, it's Landlubber Day tomorrow.
And you'd all wear them on the same day.
That was high school.
So wait, these were bib overhaul skirts? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
They were really ugly when I look back now.
I'm trying to even figure out what that would look like. Like, who is there somebody that I would know that wore those? Was that their signature look that I could think of?
Think Lulu on Hee Haw.
Lulu Roman?
No. Because this had a flared skirt. This wasn't like, you know, junior sample skirt.
Oh, all right.
Although you could get samples at the outlet store.
When people would see you in the hall, would you all go, howdy, at the same time?
That's a yes.
Why would we do that?
It just seems in the keeping of Hee Haw.
It didn't look Hee Haw-esque.
A salute to Minnie Pearl. A little teenager salute to Minnie Pearl.
I will find it. We have to take a break.
All right, a quick break. More fashion ahead, more other topics ahead. We'll talk about last night's elections and other things. It's 312-981-7200 if you want to jump in, Bill and Wendy, WGN. To be fair, the same way I just said that women spend way too much time complimenting each other's clothing, I guess you could make the same argument that guys waste way more time discussing sports statistics, because that's kind of true.
It's the same thing. It's just whatever interests you.
Yeah, I know.
Speaking of home improvement, there was a friend of mine, Margot, had the coolest faucet I have ever seen, and I took a picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
And where'd you get it? And she was kind of like, oh, I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I might believe her. I might think, I don't know if she wants me to have it, but I found it online and I ordered it. And we share our faucets together. We use them at the same time.
You'll use those at the same time. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, a house that's on the end of our block all of a sudden adopted the exact same color scheme that we have on our house. The same, they painted their brickwork to be the exact same as our brickwork. They did all the doors and window trim the same way we did.
Really?
They did their roof. Yeah, it looks like our house's little brother at the end of our block. And my wife even said it was, we were driving by. My wife goes, look at this. And it took me a second, but then I realized what we were looking at. And I guess it's a compliment. But at the same time, you go, but that was the way our house looked, not their house.
See, I'm guilty of it. And yet I understand when we got our house painted, I wanted to come up with a various scheme that was different from the neighbors.
Right.
Because
to stand out a little bit more.
Yeah, and you don't want every house on the block, especially old Victorians, to look exactly the same.
Right.
So I made sure I did not go the same color scheme.
Yeah.
And you'd already ripped off their faucets.
No, she was on the other block. But I did steal an idea from my neighbor Julie, and I flat out said, I am stealing this. Are you good with it?
Oh.
And she said, yeah, whatever.
If you ask permission, it's fine.
It's just with a wraparound porch, she put some really cute little white sheer curtains on the porch for the summer. So when you're sitting on the porch, it blows in the breeze and
nice.
It's just really cool. So now I noticed everyone on the block pretty much has it.
They all do that.
Julie
now.
Started it.
Oh. Right.
And then I would put garland for the Christmas holidays. You'd see paintings of old Victorian houses with the porch and you'd just drape the garland.
Oh, yeah.
And I put lights on it.
Yeah.
I noticed a few other people started doing that on our block.
Oh.
And I was the first one on the block to do that. Not the first one ever.
But the first on the block.
But that's what this whole DIY stuff is you look at other people's ideas and
grab the ideas.
Yeah. Steal them.
Well, you do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go on Pinterest. Everybody's stealing everybody's ideas and telling you how to do it.
Right.
It's my favorite place. I love going to Pinterest.
In a little while, we've got Kristen McQuarrie of the Tribune talking about what happened politically yesterday. I said at the very end of the show, and I'd been saying this for weeks, I predicted 2 weeks ago that Marco Rubio would pull out on the 15th, and he did. He pulled
out on
the 15th.
You told us yesterday that this was going to happen.
I said at the end of the show, and Kevin will tell you, I've been moaning about this for a couple of weeks, is that at some point you realize no matter how hard you've fought a battle, it's a battle you're not going to win. So I do give him some credit. But then yesterday I heard the concession speech, and I always make fun of when they use the phrase, I'm suspending my campaign, because they're not suspending it. They're halting it altogether. It's not existing anymore. They're not suspending it.
Unless they need those delegates in Cleveland.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask Steve is this. He's got, I think, 136 delegates or something like that. What happens to the delegates that have already committed to Marco Rubio? How do they split those up? They still exist in some way.
That's a good question.
And I think that, you know, a lot of times the vanquished will release their delegates at the convention sort of as a show of unity. So I think Hillary Clinton might have, you know, released her delegates 8 years ago to Barack Obama.
Yeah.
If not, they can hold on to them, and you know, they would be voted for Rubio on the first ballot.
But in the case like what you just said with Hillary Clinton with Barack Obama, he was far and away he was the guy. It came
right.
down
he
to
was
just him.
Be the guy, so.
But with the Republicans at this point, there's still three. You could argue semi-viable options. So. Is it up to Marco Rubio to decide who gets those? That can't be. Can
I don't
it?
Think Marco Rubio can. I don't think he can declare that they go to Kasich, but he can release them and suggest that they vote for Kasich.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Wow, that could be a game changer.
It turns out it's
not
136,
really. Yeah.
So it's not enough to be a game changer, but it is.
Kasich had nothing to begin with when this all started, so he's
right.
definitely
right.
moving on up.
Right.
Will he move up more? Above Trump? No, but
I always feel bad when somebody, this was a clear-cut case of a guy's dream being dashed. Marco Rubio, I'm sure he's had other goals in politics, but I guess the end goal is to be the president, and then at some point you realize it's just not meant to be. So I know this is a weird thing to think about, but I was thinking about what's the rest of his night like when you're laying in bed and you think, boy, except for a couple of strange circumstances, I could have been the president, but instead I was making a speech explaining to everybody it's not going to be me.
He called Al Gore. They commiserated.
Yeah.
What did you do?
Well, he could call tons of people from the Republican side, yes, you know, from of recent times.
He and Ben Carson went out for dinner.
Maybe. That might have happened. Or Mike Huckabee or Rand Paul or Carly Fiorina, or the list goes on and on.
They had a loser party.
Football team.
Right, it is. It is.
That's sad.
But the same way, like, you know, when you pass some shop or business or something that's going out of business, and I don't know if you feel this, but I always feel a tinge of, oh, man, that's their dream going up in smoke. I'm not a big fan of Marco Rubio's, but for a little while last night, I'm thinking, oh, man, he's laying in bed right now going, eh, could have been the president, but instead I made that speech tonight saying it won't be me.
He would have made a cute president, too.
He would have been a cute president. They should have played that up. I'm your cutest option.
Well,
that would have been a better selling point for him.
That's how Nixon lost. So
how did he? I know this is a question for Kristen McQuarrie, and we can ask her. But everybody said from day one, well, Florida, I mean, that's his own home state. I mean, that's basically a given, and it was far from a given. How did he not get his home state?
Well, he was criticized for one thing, for not voting a lot in the Senate.
Yeah.
So if you're a Floridian and you say, well, my guy's not even there taking the votes.
Yeah.
That could make you angry. Donald Trump is almost a Floridian himself.
Yeah.
So you've got that going on. And, you know, the biggest criticism the Republicans are saying right now is, look, we got to replace this cute one-term senator who was elected to the office of president.
Right.
Right. We got to get rid of Obama because he wasn't experienced and he did a lousy job. So the Republican version of that, the first term cute senator in your terms, you know, if that's Marco Rubio.
That is, you got to admit it.
It's kind of a tough thing to vote for.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you can't argue that Obama wasn't ready and then say Rubio was. Or Rubio, you can't convince people that you were ready if you're trying to say that Obama wasn't.
But weren't you shocked? I mean, from day one, and he was one of the golden boys of the party, from day one, they go, well, you know, Florida's his home state. So, I mean, what would have to happen for him to not take Florida? And did he get half of what Donald Trump got in Florida, even half?
He might have gotten half, yeah. It was a blowout, though.
There's no way to predict what's going on these days.
Not anymore.
Yeah,
no.
It's completely different.
Yeah. All right, we'll take a break. Steve's got the news. Kristen McQuarrie will join us, and we will discuss what went on yesterday. Stay where you are. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. Steve, thanks. It's Bill and Wendy, along with Kristen McQuarrie of the Chicago Tribune, to talk about what happened politically yesterday. We were just saying off air, Kristen, and I want to bring it on air as well. It seems like this particular election has been going on for years. We still have 8 months to go until the November election. But it just seems this time around, and I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's the subject matter or the candidates or what. It just seems like we've been in this particular election for years now.
It does. It feels like it started in 1932.
Right.
No, we were just saying that the first, you know, when all of this jumped on my radar was the first GOP debate that Fox News held. And that was in early August. And that was where Trump and Megyn Kelly sort of got into it about some of Trump's comments about women. I mean, August.
Yeah.
It feels like it's been a long road, and sure feels that way.
Last night, if you look at what happened, no major surprises, right? Was there anything that happened yesterday that really stood out as a shocker to anybody?
I don't think so. I mean, there are the close race between Clinton and Bernie Sanders in Illinois. That was a little bit surprising.
This is
her home state. And there was a time early in the night where I thought, oh, my gosh, she might lose. There were a lot of questions on national media about her and the connection to Rahm Emanuel. And so I think there's a whole backstory there about, you know, that Rahm was really a drag on the ticket, which is probably sort of new territory for him. Statewide, you know, I think the reflection that I think is true about elections oftentimes, we rail against our government. We talk, you know, we have this whole term limits, throw the bums out, and then we reelect all the incumbents.
Right.
And that's kind of what happened. Mike Madigan did really well last night, the House Speaker, all of his races. You know, he reelected a lot of the same caucus members and beat back Governor Bruce Rauner, who had tried to insert some more rebellious Democrats. So, you know, I guess we can't complain too much about our representation if we keep voting the same people in.
And Anita Alvarez took a big hit, which you kind of knew was coming. All the protests and everything. Well, this is why you have a voice when you vote.
Exactly. I mean, I think Anita Alvarez is a very talented prosecutor, but when you make big missteps, which I think she did, that she was still unable to explain why she waited until the videotape was released to actually charge that officer. There's
the
a price
Laquan
to
pay McDonald.
In the Laquan McDonald case, exactly, who was shot 16 times by an officer, and it took 14 months for charges to actually come
out. Of murder.
Out.
That
of
did
murder.
Go down.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. If you wouldn't mind, go back just a second for me to the link between Hillary Clinton and Mayor Emanuel. Is that the sort of thing, if you get if she becomes the candidate for the Democratic side, does the Republican side, probably Trump, but if it's not Trump, whoever's on the Republican side, does that become an issue, the fact that she's got some history with Rahm Emanuel? Do they play that out even bigger?
I could see it happening. I mean, I don't know that it would play outside of Illinois, but I think around here, I mean, the Laquan McDonald shooting was an international story. And so if you can somehow kind of rev up that whole Black Lives Matter movement and start to subtract some of her support from her African-American base, which is really important, it could be somewhat damaging to her.
Yeah.
So John Kasich scores really well in his home state of Ohio. But what does that mean?
You know, it gives
it too late.
I think so. I mean, when Ted Cruz won Texas, it gives you a little bump. You get a little more press. You get a little more attention. You have people saying, you know, why haven't we been paying attention to this guy for all this time? Why don't the people at the debates ask him more questions? So it gives him a little bump, but he has to follow up with another big win. And I just don't see that happening. The next primaries are in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, I think, and he's not polling well in those places.
I've heard so many experts say over the years that the key in all this is you have to win your home state because nobody knows you better than the people of your home state. And when you don't, what does that tell the rest of the country? That's true, isn't it?
It's very true. I mean, the people up close are the ones who know you best. And I remember that criticism, though, of Bill Clinton when he was running, that his popularity numbers were very low in Arkansas, but you know, people know you best. And so they know all the little secrets in your closets. And I think probably with Marco Rubio, it wasn't just that. They have been able to see him up close, but I think he lost for the reason that he lost in other states too. And he wasn't conservative enough. He wasn't angry enough. He compromised on that immigration bill. And a lot of people saw that as amnesty. And that hard right Republican voter just was not willing to tolerate it. So he lost.
But if you look at who the golden boys were, the Republican Party, the last couple of years, the people that everybody touted as the best chances of getting it, his name was always at the top of the list. Every single time you'd hear his name, you'd hear Bobby Jindal's name over and over and over and over. He fizzled quickly. But how did he go from being one of those guys that everybody said is a can't-miss prospect, this is the guy who's probably our next president, to a guy that just never really seemed to have the interest he should have had? What happened?
He had kind of spikes and valleys. I mean, he sort of charged onto the scene as a Tea Party candidate, and he's young and he's well educated, and he I mean, he has a great rags to riches story, which he talked about during his acceptance speech. So all of these issues made him a force to be reckoned with, but I think maybe he tried to ascend a little too quickly. It could just take one misstep and you sort of fall off the scene in these presidential elections or in any election. And that night he stumbled and kept repeating himself and did badly in New Hampshire because Chris Christie sort of pointed out that he was like a little robot.
Yeah.
I think that was a pretty big setback too.
And as we left yesterday, you had said Marco Rubio will be bailing by today, I think you said.
2 weeks ago, I said the 15th is his day that he announces he's done. He can't do it anymore because it just lined up that way. This was a big state to not win in. His home state of Florida was a big state to not win in. And there was no indication. You know, you talk about momentum. He just never really seemed to have the momentum he would need to make any kind of a difference.
And the question came up, and I don't know if Steve answered it, and forgive me, Bertrand, if that's the case, but Bill raised a great question. What happens to those delegates that Marco Rubio had, where do they go?
Well, it's one reason why you'll notice during his speech he said he's suspending his campaign, which they all say. But you want to use...
That bothers Bill more than anything in the world.
It's, I heard you talk about that.
That phrase is ridiculous because suspend means
but they
to temporarily...
have backers and what, you know, suspending your campaign, especially Marco Rubio, he'll be back, right? I mean, isn't that the way you do it? Suspend it?
I think so. I'm
ending
sure
it
there
for
are
now?
Like
not this, but not for this election. Maybe in 4 years or 8 years, but he's not coming back this time around.
No, but he could be in play if this whole election goes down to the convention and Donald Trump does not get the number of delegates he needs, the delegates for candidates, and somebody will correct me, I'm sure if I'm up, the delegates for candidates who have dropped out on the second balloting process, they're free agents. Oh. So he has a little leverage to try to, you know, maybe send his delegates Ted Cruz's way. This is all, of course, if we end up with some sort of a brokered convention.
So do these guys, do the three remaining guys at this point court him in some respect? Do they try to convince Marco Rubio that all things are good and I should be the guy? Does that go
on? Oh, yeah. They were doing it last night. Just I love after, you know, ripping him to shreds for months. And then when he finally steps down, Marco Rubio is just an American hero. Yeah. And we're so grateful
ran
for his
a great campaign.
He ran
they
a
all
great
said.
Campaign. You know, one thing, I don't know if he said this in his speech or I read this somewhere last night, but the reason he knew he was going to lose Florida, but the reason he stayed in is because he wanted his mother to be able to vote for him for president of the United States. And I thought
that is sweet.
That is sweet. And that would be, you know, if you're a principled person, you realize, you know, you owe all of this to your parents. Dad was a bartender. Mom was a maid.
Yeah.
He wanted to stick it out long enough so she could check that box.
All right. Well, there's that.
Does anybody need a tissue?
You got to vote for his
mom. I know,
mom.
It's really sweet.
What if his mom came forward and said, you know what, I went Kasich at the last minute, I looked at the box. All right, we'll take a quick break. Kristen McQuarrie's here. If you have any questions or comments, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. It is Bill and Wendy on WGN, and Kristen McQuarrie is our guest. We're talking about what happened politically last night. A lot went down. No major surprises, as we mentioned. What exactly is the relationship at this point between Donald Trump and Chris Christie? It's a very confusing one to me. I used to watch soap operas, but I've never seen a soap opera like this. Are they friends? Are they enemies? Are they frenemies?
I think they're frenemies. I think they're friends by necessity. And I mean, Christie's home state went berserk when he endorsed Donald Trump and really saw
I
that
think Christie's wife went berserk.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people saw it as kind of a sellout move.
Mm-hmm. A suck up, sellout. What's the difference?
Yeah, just such a blatant play for vice president. So we'll see if, I mean, this is kind of what it's looking like. He's standing behind him. He's campaigning for him. Maybe he is a top contender for a running mate at some point.
He is actually. He is one of the top contenders, right? Every list I see, it's the same six or seven names, and his name is always on there.
He is. It's just Donald Trump being from New York, it would make geographic sense for him to choose someone maybe from the Midwest or another big delegate state or big population state, and perhaps a woman. If that, you know, you want to kind of have balance on the ticket, and I'm just not sure what the calculus is if Christie fits that profile.
Sarah Palin's name keeps getting mentioned.
Oh, no. Please,
you
no,
don't see that?
No.
Gary Busey's name keeps getting
that
mentioned.
That I can see. Dressed as a woman.
Dressed as a woman, of course.
All right, so Chris Christie throws his support to Trump, and Ben Carson does, too. Is it too late? I mean, it looks like Ben Carson's looking for a role in this possible legislation, this... you know, if Trump becomes, I can't even
it
say
could it. Be like in his cabinet or something.
Yes,
people have talked about he would be a great, you know,
commissioner of gentleness.
Isn't he, though?
He's very gentle.
He would stroke your head and talk so softly. Right. He'd be so comforting.
He's very soothing. And he closes his eyes when he speaks like this. So,
Like Gilbert Gottfried.
He'd be like the minister of something. I think that's part of it. And I think a lot of the candidates do have a sincere, effort to try to throw their supporters to who they think they can win. They're all united in that they don't want a Democrat. They don't want Hillary Clinton. So they are trying to shove their supporters a little bit to, you know, whoever they think can win.
Should we take some calls?
Yeah, please. 312-981-7200 is the way to do it.
Tom, you have a question for Kristen McQuarrie from the Chicago Tribune.
I have a two-part question. One is, I thought the law said you had to be born in the United States of America to run for president. Why is Cruz allowed to stay there, number one? And number two, I don't live in Chicago, and I can't understand why we aren't allowed to vote for Madigan. And he controls our tax dollars also, not just Chicago's.
Okay. So you have to be a natural-born citizen, is the term in the Constitution. And the interpretation of that over the years has included people who were born overseas to American parents, like John McCain was born in Panama because he had parents who were in the military. You can't penalize in certain situations, children who are born elsewhere, if their parents are serving the country or are American citizens themselves. And as to the Madigan question, you know, he is a state lawmaker just like the other 177 lawmakers who represents a small district on the south side. And that it's just like, you know, he gets elected to his seat and then the rest of the Democrats get to choose him as their leader. That's just the way it works. If you want to be anti-Madigan, you could have tried to help his opponent. He did have one. He lost badly last night, his opponent, Jason Gonzalez, but, it's difficult, or you can just not send Democrats to Springfield because they're the ones who then choose him to be their speaker.
But if you have $50 to run for re-election or to run to get a nominator to get elected, and you have somebody like Madigan who has millions, what do you think your chances are of winning?
Well, just to play devil's advocate here, Bruce Rauner put a lot of money into his opponent, put a lot of money into a couple of races, and they lost last night. So it does take more than just money. The Madigan had a big fight on his hands. He actually had to go walk door to door in his district and kind of campaign like a real person. And he was reelected. So money doesn't always, you know, equate victory.
But it helps a lot and makes you more comfortable.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. It helps. It helps a lot. I mean, Madigan had lots of money to trash up his opponent, money for, to hire campaign workers, to have mailers, to have television commercials, to have boots on the ground the day of the election, knocking on people's doors, trying to get them to the polls. I mean, all of those things are how you win elections, and it all costs money.
Thank you so much, Tom. We appreciate your call.
Kristen, you were kind enough to do a little research. We had you on yesterday at the very top of the show, and we were saying that in addition to the five states that had primaries yesterday, you know, the U.S. has territories around the world, and one of those territories are the Northern Mariana Islands, which are a little bit north of the Philippines.
That's
if everybody
correct.
Wants to look at C8 on their maps.
Bingo.
we have a winner. All right.
Bingo.
Will you be on my trivia, like my church trivia night?
Yeah,
do my
I'd be happy to help you out with
section.
That. Sure,
okay.
sure. All right, so the question I had is this. There's delegates, Wendy informed us yesterday, because I didn't even think they had delegates, but there are delegates
nine.
That come. There's nine of them. Or were you yelling at me no in German? I'm not sure.
Both.
Either way.
Yeah, and Trump got all nine of them. That's how I remember the story.
He ran the table in the Northern Mariana Islands.
They love him.
They love him. He's got a lot
huge.
Of friends from Northern Mariana Islands. So the question is this. He won. Okay, that's good. But now here's what happens. The Electoral College will come up at some point, and they're not represented at all, much like American Samoa or any other U.S. territory around the country, around the world. So what does it mean to those people who live in those territories who vote? Their votes don't count, do they?
They don't. I mean,
they don't.
That's so sad.
But they count to the extent that the candidates are actually trying to court them, because they, even if they can't be part of the Electoral College, they could still play a role in the delegate count. So let me give you a quick example. I just ran across this Time. Oh, no, it was Politico, I think, had a story.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton won two more delegates than Bernie Sanders from the Northern Marianas Islands.
Yeah.
So she won two, and I think, or she won four and he won two. Real, I mean, four delegates. But do you know they put in like time and effort to track people down, including if you ordered a Hillary Clinton for president t-shirt on
yeah.
Facebook or online and you had a Northern Marianas address, they reached out to you and emailed you and tried to get you to coalesce around the candidate. They did phone calls. They did like phone banking, emailing, and using social media to actually try to organize.
They did. It means that much to the party.
For four delegates. Wow. Because I think last time around with Obama, he was very good at just going after that delegate count, and the Clinton campaign was not as persistent about it. So now they are aggressively going after even these tiny little delegate.
And they
counts.
Have traditionally been an incredible predictor of who wins the election, the Northern Mariana Islands. I don't know how they do it.
I'm letting the people there pick my brackets.
Over in the Northern
really
yeah,
good, yes.
the same people.
Yeah.
Wow.
I have a listener who wants to ask you a question, Bill, but I'll pit you against Kristen McQueary. Can you name the only living president that is eligible for another term in the White House? And I don't know. You'll have to check
Bush.
Your facts.
Bush Herbert.
Bush the original mm-hmm. recipe Bush. let's see.
That's not
him?
The answer this person is giving.
Oh, well, he only served one term, so I'm thinking he would still be eligible. No?
I'm trying to think of who else it would.
He liked peanuts.
Would it be Jimmy Carter?
That's what the answer is, according to this text.
Also because he was a one-termer?
Don't know the answer. Yeah. Okay. I just wanted to throw it out there.
George Bush has got to be the other answer to that.
I think so.
Okay, so listener, take that. There are two, not the only living president, two of them.
Can we expect either of those gentlemen to enter the race, Kristen, do you think?
If there's a third-party resurgence,
then maybe.
Maybe. All right, anyway. Let's cross our fingers for the next 90-year-old candidate.
Yeah. That's who the GOP is going to put up instead of Trump. The original recipe.
All right. I would love to see that. That would be fun. Kristen, thank you. We appreciate it. It's Kristen McQuarrie. Read her in the Chicago Tribune. We're going to take a break, and then Steve will give you the news. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.
Who are you wearing, Bill?
I'm wearing Garanimals right now. Is that good or bad? I don't know. Wendy, did you know that Hollywood has a lot of secrets? Were you aware that Hollywood,
that's the hub of
show business, the very epicenter of movie making, is loaded with various secrets, things that you and I shouldn't know?
I did not know that.
It's true. I have a bunch of these. These are Hollywood's greatest well-kept secrets.
These are going to be good, aren't
they? I'm going to spill the beans. I'm going to tell people what's going on behind the scenes of your favorite Hollywood films. Here's one about Jack Nicholson. Now, there was a time not long ago that Jack Nicholson was the coolest guy in Hollywood. Would you agree?
Yeah, he had that.
He was cool. Mr. Cool.
Yep, you're right.
If you'd watch the Academy Awards, you'd always see the host doing some joke about Jack Nicholson, and they'd cut to him, and he had sunglasses on even though he was inside. He's that cool. He can wear sunglasses inside. Jack Nicholson, tell me if you knew this about him. Jack Nicholson grew up in a seemingly normal house until he learned that his parents had actually been his maternal grandparents and that his sister, or the girl he thought was his sister, was really his mother. Did you know that about Jack Nicholson?
That has a movie written all over
it. Well, it's ironic because in the movie Chinatown, and I do have to say spoiler alert here to anyone who's not seen Chinatown, there's an incredible scene with he and Faye Dunaway where she finds out something pretty much identical to this.
All right, I don't have to see the movie now.
Well, you should
see. How many years has it been out?
It came out in the 1970s, I believe. So
I'm a little busy.
You should see it before it evaporates. But there is a scene, a very violent scene with he and Faye Dunaway where they make a very similar discovery. And, you know,
that's so
he had
weird.
This actually happen to him.
I mean, it's one thing to have your grandparents step up and great for them. I know there are a lot of grandparents listening that are raising their kids for some reason or another. But to find out the woman you thought was your sister was really your mother, that's wild.
And that your mother was actually your grandmother. He didn't know when they had a family reunion. He didn't know where to sit. He's like, do I sit here? Do I sit over there? I don't know where to sit.
Why do you think he wears sunglasses all the time?
Right. It makes it easy.
It does.
Right. And when he would do, a lot of times when you see impressionists do an impression of Jack Nicholson, they'll hold their hand up to their hair and pull it back. And he never did that, ever. I don't know why impressionists do that, but he never did it.
Because he had a receding hairline. Isn't that why they were
doing
that?
I guess. But I think, I don't know, maybe. Frank Sinatra, it says here.
Was Italian.
Yes. Oh, you already knew that one. Even though he sold himself as a Scandinavian crooner, Wendy, Frank Sinatra was in fact Italian. That's one of Hollywood's
expected he was a Norse god
greatest
somewhere.
Secrets. Frank Sinatra has been a true American dream success story. He was born to this proves your story. He was born to Italian immigrants in New Jersey. He was expelled from high school. He taught himself to sing.
I wish I knew that.
For being cool, for being tough. They weren't back then. They didn't allow that kind of thing. He taught himself to sing. He made money at local bars with his talent. He went on to win an Oscar and to be one of the most successful artists of all time. But it says here, according to Hollywood's Greatest Secrets, Wendy, much of this was due to his mafia ties.
Sinatra, this is not a surprising thing.
No,
at this
anyone
point.
Who knows Frank Sinatra already knows this. Sinatra was known to be well acquainted with mob bosses such as Sam Giancana, or Momo, as we called him in the business, in the trades, Momo Giancana, and Charles.
The trades?
Yeah. If you're a made man, like I am,
you
we
are.
Called, yes. Yes. I am made, but my bed is not. That's what my mafia business card says. He was also a friend of Charles Lucky Luciano and Mario Puzo, who's the author of The Godfather.
The Godfather, yep. Yes.
He wrote about Sinatra's rise in Hollywood and how he was able to win roles in larger movies over other experienced contenders, thanks largely to his mafia friend's influence. So this has been debated for a long time, is exactly how far Frank Sinatra would have gotten had he not been pals with the mafiosos. But you got to admit, that was one talented guy. I think he would have probably reached some level of success, right? Don't you think?
I agree.
Yeah. Now, this is one that you and I have actually a connection to, but I don't know if you'll even remember the connection. Do you remember years ago at another radio station when we had Todd Rundgren on?
Yes.
Do you remember him being very surly?
I don't really remember.
He was very surly.
What, we talked to him?
But it was not because of you. It was because of me. Because we were doing an interview with Todd Rundgren and everything was fine. And then I brought up a story that had just recently been in the news. And that's that Liv Tyler, the actress Liv Tyler, always believed, I'm trying to remember now if it was Todd Rundgren. No, her father is Steven Tyler, obviously. But she grew up believing that Todd Rundgren was her father. And then right before we had him on, like a month before, it came out that her real father was Steven Tyler. You would think with the name Liv Tyler, she could have done the math on that, but she did not.
You are a made man. You're
she also
smarty.
Thought her uncle was Momo Giancana.
Well, you cut it out.
Right. So we had him on, and you were doing your job as well you should to ask him about being Todd Rundgren. And then I go, oh, by the way, Todd, you were in the news, this thing with Liv Tyler. And then he claimed to not know anything about it. When in reality, he knew everything about it. He just didn't want to talk about it.
What's wrong with me? We have done some great shows in the past and talked to some great people, and yeah. I don't remember anything.
Yeah. Well, this...
What station?
This at the Loop.
Really?
Can I say... I can't say another
no.
station. WLUP. Liv Tyler was actually born with the name Liv Rundgren and grew up thinking that her father was actually rocker Todd Rundgren, who was mean to Bill Leff.
Liv, well, Bill Leff asked him something that he should have had to be the
probably,
last question.
Well, in retrospect, I probably should have.
Or
waited till he hung up
and then
asked the question. That would have been better.
No, because you're a made man. You can't look
I
weak.
Am a made man.
So, but just let that be the last question, because then if they get mad, you've already had a
the
pretty decent
over.
Interview.
Good point. I was new to the game. Liv had the chance then to meet Steven Tyler when she was 8 years old, and it was then that she started questioning her paternity. Because you got to admit, they look exactly alike, don't they?
No.
You don't think they do?
No.
Liv Tyler and Steven Tyler? I see a resemblance.
I think Steven looks like his other daughter more.
Oh,
a
little
think
Mia.
Yeah,
her
yeah,
name
yeah.
is Mia, a little bit. Bebe Buell, former Playboy playmate and Liv's mother, eventually told her, right before her interview with you and I, that her biological father was the Aerosmith singer, but that she had kept it a secret because he had led a very hard-partying rocker lifestyle.
That's like my mom never told me that I was half Irish she told me I was half Irish because Schneider comes from Schneider.
Which is German.
Right. And my mom kept denying that because she didn't like Hitler.
Oh. Your mom was the one who didn't like Hitler.
Right. Can you believe her?
So just because, like, what did she think would happen?
I was 30-some years old working at the Loop again. I was in my 30s and, you know, with Tony Fitzpatrick.
Yeah.
And she said... Yes, I told her that she was half Italian from my side and half Irish because my dad was dead and couldn't dispute it.
Oh.
And I said, well, Snyder is German, isn't it? Yeah. Well, he was more Irish. It's just the name.
Oh.
And honestly, I was almost 30 years old when I found out that I had German in me.
But then I think the name Snyder or Schneider, I think, is always German.
I know.
I think.
I just never. My mom just said, you're half Italian, half Irish. So that's what I said until my 30s. And then Tony broke her down on the air and said, why did you lie to your daughter for all these years? Well, Hitler wasn't a very nice man. And Tony said, well, neither was Mussolini.
No, he wasn't. He was also not a nice man.
That shut my mom up.
Wow. Wow.
So I see where parents lie sometimes. Sometimes for good reasons. Sometimes for crazy ones.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We've got people calling in. We are telling you Hollywood's deepest, darkest secrets.
If you
want to jump in, we're at 312-981-7200. If you're on hold, stay there. We'll get to some calls next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN. We're telling you, and I don't think we're supposed to be telling you, but we are telling you Hollywood's deepest, darkest secrets. These are secrets that nobody knew, like the fact that Frank Sinatra might have been connected to the mafia. That's a huge secret. Don't tell anybody where you heard this, folks. Please, we don't want to get in trouble.
Someone says Bill, Jack Nicholson's situation is nothing like Chinatown, where Faye Dunaway is something else is something else.
All right, then let me just say this. Mother, daughter, mother, daughter. If anyone saw Chinatown, they know what that means.
When is your one-man play, your one-act play?
I will be doing my one-man show, Reggie, at the... Why is that funny? Why is that funny? It's coming up. It's coming up. Alfred Hitchcock, Wendy, as it turns out, not the nicest man.
I've heard that so many times.
Not a nice man. Someone referred to him as a stalker. His nickname in Hollywood, of course, was the Master of Suspense. He was the pioneer of many new techniques in the suspense world, in the in the psychological thriller genre. But
he did some physical things too, I've heard.
He was not so nice to his leading ladies. He used to, I'll paraphrase this a little bit, he tended to fall in love with his leading ladies.
Well, look at the leading ladies.
Oh, they were some of the most beautiful women in Hollywood.
Absolutely.
At the time, you had Kim Novak, you had Janet Leigh, you had Grace Kelly.
Tippi Hedren.
Do you tippy 15% or 20%?
20.
Some of the leading ladies in his films, such as the women we just mentioned, have all told stories of his inappropriate advances.
Yep, I've heard this 100 times.
They've made a couple of movies about it recently, saying what a lech he could be. Tippi Hedren, however. Tippi Hedren. What did I say? Hedren? That's not right.
That's what you do.
However, was the target of his most aggressive stalking. He began paying crew members to spy on her, and when she denied his advances, he took to ruining her career by trapping her in a contract that prevented her from working for years after the movie The Birds was released.
I wondered why she never was in anything.
She did, like, bit parts in movies later on, but she was so popular after The Birds and just never was able to capitalize on it.
Melanie Griffith's mother.
Right. But Janet Leigh,
Steven Tyler is her father.
She found out years later that Steven Tyler was her father, and that was tough for her because he's younger than her.
Weird. How do you figure it out?
I think
Steven,
Steven, father, Steven, father. That's a scene that got cut out of Chinatown. I think Janet Leigh was the only one who came to his defense later on and
said she
didn't have any hard times with him; that he was a gentleman. So what
she
do we know?
She seemed like she believed in herself more than the other leading
Janet
women.
Janet Leigh did.
Didn't she seem like she had much more self-confidence?
Yeah, I think she did. I do think she did. Now, this is one I was not aware of. And this is just plain ugly. Listen to this. Before the days, if you're just joining us, Hollywood's deepest, darkest secrets. Before the days of unions and safety standards, film stunts were real. They didn't know how to pretend doing film stunts, so they would have to actually do things. And listen to this example.
Like the Three Stooges, for instance.
Yeah, they actually would lay on the ground and spin around. They would poke each other in the eyes. Michael Curtis, who directed the movie Casablanca and then went on to make epic films like Noah's Ark, explains that in one of the scenes where floodwaters washed away the crowds of people, the extras were assembled, and then gallons of frigid water were dumped onto the extras until the entire studio was flooded. The extras, however, were not informed of this beforehand.
Well, they didn't have their raincoat on. They weren't ready to roll.
No.
But what a real, genuine reaction.
I guess that's what they were going for. The extras were not informed that they'd be flooding the studio, and they were wearing heavy costumes, and they had no flotation devices. And they were, although in the film that would have looked suspect.
Yeah, absolutely.
The giant rains came and everybody pulled out a raft. People would have wondered, well, how did they know this? They were forced to stay in the water for hours. According to one person on the set, three extras actually drowned during the making of Noah's Ark. No charges were filed, and the public never knew of this until this moment when I divulged it.
No charges filed, and no animals were hurt in the making of Noah's Ark, but three people died.
They had to be very careful with the animals. They didn't want Steve Dale's grandfather.
Great-grandfather
at the time. He would have been upset. So, how about that?
That's pretty interesting.
Now, there's another one, but I think everybody knows about you. You pick between these, but I think everybody in the world knows between these two. One of them is that Tom Cruise, as it turns out, is involved in Scientology.
These
are Hollywood's deepest, darkest secrets, Wendy.
Who's putting this together? A 6-year-old?
A 6-year-old writer is, he put these together. And then the other one, now I've never heard this before, Marilyn Monroe was involved with the Kennedys.
I've never heard that either. Crazy lady.
Marilyn Monroe, it says here, was well known for both her unstable behavior. What?
And her stable of Kennedys.
And her stable of Kennedys.
Brothers.
She was involved with all of them at some point, wasn't she?
And
Frank Sinatra.
Wasn't she?
Yeah.
Or am I imagining that?
McGilla Gorilla. Did you know that? No, it says here only two of the Kennedy brothers, John and Robert Kennedy.
Right.
Not Ted Kennedy for some reason.
Oh, no. I didn't think Ted. Not Ted, Ted was Kennedy. Busy somewhere else with someone else.
Right, right.
On a bridge.
It has been widely speculated for decades there was a mutual attraction between Marilyn Monroe and the Kennedy boys. And when Monroe performed a seductive version of Happy Birthday, Mr. President.
Who could resist that?
I got to admit, that would be almost impossible.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
So you got somebody who comes here and sings Happy Birthday to you like that in a dress
right.
like that.
Right.
You're smitten.
You had a guy come and do balloon animals for me on my birthday, and it was hard to resist. We're going to do news next, and then Walter Jacobson will give his unique perspective on everything that happened during the presidential situations
the
yesterday. The primary took place yesterday in Illinois. What do we need to know? Walter will help us with that. More ahead, Bill and Wendy, WGN. Wendy, sitting to my right and right across from you is Walter Jacobson. One of the best that's ever been when it comes to Chicago news and politics, and he's here to give us his perspective on what we saw yesterday. It's an honor to be here with you again, Walter.
It's so nice to be here with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely.
And it was a big night. It really was a hugely wonderful night for Hillary, as yeah. you all know.
Yeah.
Although I was worried for a little bit. It was pretty neck and neck with Bernie Sanders and Hillary.
You know, all of us in the media keep talking about neck and neck. It's not neck and neck. The votes had already been cast.
It was 46.52% when I was looking at counting. You're
and
right.
And you were worried you wanted Hillary to be more comfortably in first place?
I thought she would be more comfortably in place in her hometown.
Yeah. Well, she's doing better than we expected in a month ago or 3 weeks ago since she lost surprisingly in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And Bernie has had a lot of momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And Hillary now has switched the momentum. There was a poll out the other day that showed that she's even gaining in young voters, which she really needs. And she's wrapping herself in Barack, which is good for her because, you know, Barack now has a 50% positive rating, the highest he's had in 3 years. So it's good for her to wrap herself in him.
When people call this election, the presidential election, the one where anything can happen, is that an understatement or an overstatement?
Oh my God, it's turned into be a understatement much rather than an overstatement.
Yeah.
People who watch politics closely really expect more things than the general public expect or think they know. Hillary has got a way to go, but she's got enough delegates to make it clear that she's the one to beat.
Yeah.
The unexpected thing, of course, was Donald Trump. I mean, the guy is really a character, and everybody has completely underestimated him, primarily the media, you know, the commentariat, the talking heads on television, on cable, always saying that Donald Trump is doing something wrong. Bad guy, bad guy, bad guy. And every time they do that, he gains popularity.
No such thing as negative press.
Yeah, he is just so smart, and everybody thinks he's not. But do you think it's possible that Donald Trump didn't know in advance that that there would be protests at the UIC? Donald Trump doesn't, with his points of view on things, doesn't go to a college campus and not expect to have trouble.
Right.
So I think he kind of planned it. I think his strategist said he could have held that, of course, rally anywhere.
Right.
But to hold it in a UIC auditorium was asking for trouble, and it's the kind of trouble he wants. And all of the talking heads on television kept saying, my God, he has caused this violence. What a bad man he is. And it's going to hurt him because the people are going to come out, and we'll all understand what a bad guy Donald Trump is. All he did was gain more support. And you
he's
know
a
what?
Smart guy, but it just gets me nervous, him running this country.
How about the George Romney?
Mm-hmm.
Remember George, right?
Mm-hmm.
He came in at the last minute to condemn Donald Trump in a really virulent speech.
That's Mitt's real name? Mitt Romney's real name is George?
Did I say George? That's his father.
Yes.
Oh,
father.
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry.
I thought
that was maybe his
nickname.
No.
I can see thinking of George Romney.
Oh, yeah.
Mitt Romney came in and made that really tough speech against Donald Trump.
Yep.
I wouldn't be surprised if Trump and his people conned him into doing that, because that turned more people in favor of Trump.
Isn't that something, though, when the last two candidates, him and McClain, both say, Jim McCain, both say extremely negative things about the direction that the party would be taking if he was the candidate, and in both those cases, it did nothing but help.
That's right, and he now is getting so close that it will be very hard, if not impossible, to stop him.
Yeah.
You know, his position is that if he has won more than 50% of the votes that have been cast in the primaries, when he gets to the convention, the party should not deny him the nomination just because the leaders of the party don't like him and don't trust him.
Right.
And that's a pretty strong argument. If he's winning the popular vote and he goes to the convention and he has a good number of delegates, but not quite the number to get over the 1,200 barrier.
Yeah.
They shouldn't deny it from him. I don't
know. Yeah. And he said there will be riots if that happens. I'm sure there will be.
Well, you know, all of which is very good for us, because the crazier they get and the more we don't know, the more we like to know, and the more
we
fun
pay attention.
It is for us.
Yeah. The discussion that we've had here on the show on days you're not here, Walter, is that even though he gives a twisted reality, he, in a weird way, I know this is hard to fathom, but he's kind of good for politics because it's made a lot more people pay attention. Do you agree with that?
I certainly do agree with that, right. And he's good for politics because he stirs up the establishment.
Yeah.
They don't like him in Washington because they're afraid that they can't tell him what to do.
Yeah.
And they can't.
No, and they sure can't.
He works
for
himself.
You know, we shouldn't be too positive. The guy is really off the deep end. You
know? Sure.
No telling what he'll do when he gets in office.
Of course.
If he gets in office.
Yeah, please say if.
It sure is bad. It's just horrible for the Republican Party, which just will stand for nothing now.
Yeah. Do you subscribe to this theory? Everyone on both sides, on the Republican side and the Democratic side, likes to fancy themselves a political outsider. I'm somebody who's coming at it from a whole new angle. I don't like what's going on in Washington. I heard Ted Cruz yesterday during his speech talk about how it's really time to fight against your typical politicians and stuff. But he's talking about himself.
That's right, right. He's one of the biggest of all insiders. I mean, the guy's been in the Senate only one term, less than that at this point.
Yeah.
And he's got all the support of all the people who have all the money and who have all the votes in the evangelical side of the spectrum.
Yep.
Yeah, he's an insider. It's silly for him to say he's an outsider. But, you know, all these politicians, they say what they know is not true.
Right.
Well, the big story here, as I saw it, was Bruce Rauner. I mean, Bruce Rauner is now heading this state into more serious trouble than it was before this election. For him to think that he could have run over Mike Madigan, the Speaker of the House, you know, his Democratic opposition.
Yeah.
If Bruce Rauner thought he could run over Madigan with this guy, Ken Duncan, who Rauner is supporting and spent a lot of money on to undo Madigan's strength in the General Assembly.
Yeah.
I mean, it just didn't make any sense, because he should know that. He's a rookie politician, and he's so single-minded about bringing the labor movement to its knees that he won't allow this budget to go through. He shouldn't do that.
How can we not have a budget?
How can we? We don't have a budget. We haven't had one. We're going on 9 months.
I know, and how can that be?
Well, because the main reason is, you know, it depends on who you're talking to. I'll give you my opinion. There are obviously opposite opinions. I would say the main reason is that Bruce Rauner is so determined to get his personal political agenda in order, which is to destroy the labor movement, which is to change the rules on all kinds of things that the general population wants. He's depriving the colleges of money they need to keep going. He's depriving the elderly and the disadvantaged from getting the services they need.
Yeah.
80,000 children who are being taken care of by state programs now are not being taken care of because the state does not have a budget. And he's just unwilling to compromise. Now, I think he's the one who's more unwilling to compromise. Eric Zorn, who you've had in here, agrees with that.
Yeah.
Others will say, no, it's Mike Madigan who rules the General Assembly like it's his plantation.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to lose that power. And that's why he's being stubborn about the budget.
But you got two guys that are just at polar opposites and not willing to budge. And what it means is, This lack of a budget could go on, you said 9 months, but it seriously could go on for years, couldn't it?
Well, let's not push it that far. I don't think it will do that because, you know, the pressure on both sides will get so great from the public and the editorialists that they'll have to do something, if not their own moral standards, for God's sakes. You can't run a state into the ground.
Wait, I'm writing that down. Politicians have, how did you say it, moral standards? I'm writing that down.
They also have a budget to pay themselves.
Yeah, they found a way. Yeah, there's always a way to pay yourself.
And one more good thing to look at if you're interested.
Yeah.
Is the change in the political hierarchy in Illinois. This Tony Preckwinkle and the defeat of Alvarez is a really major story because Tony Preckwinkle is the president of the Cook County Board.
Right.
An office that most people don't really know very much about. Not hugely important because most of the suburbs that it governs have their own governments. But it's an important job. Not as important as we may think it is, but it's important.
Yeah. You know?
Okay. And she, her chief of staff, as you know, was this Kim Fox.
Right.
And Tony Preckwinkle is in this political world to do in Rahm Emanuel. Tony Preckwinkle was ready to run for mayor the last time against Rahm, but kind of decided to take her time.
Yeah.
She would have won, probably. But now that she is the sort of godmother, we'll call her, of the new state's attorney, or who will be the new state's attorney, Kim Fox, and they get together, and if they want to undo Rahm Emanuel any more than he's already been undone, they get together. This is what politicians do. The state's attorney of Cook County is an enormously powerful politician. She's the one who sends politicians to jail. And if she and she's the one who decides what kinds of investigations shall be conducted, which means she decides who's going to be on the front pages of the newspapers, right? And on
which
the 10 o'clock news on television every
a
night.
A terrible picture of Anita Alvarez front page of the Sun-Times. I'm very really appalled by this.
Yeah. Yep.
It's a terrible picture at a terrible angle, and it's like they almost doctored it up to make her look worse. It really bothers me.
No, they pick pictures with an editorial point of view. That really is unfair. Yeah,
as if to say, I'm defeated, I'm crushed.
Terrible.
In that picture. We only have a second. I have to ask you this. Are you noticing with Mayor Emanuel, the swagger that was once there seems to have dissipated a little bit? Do you notice that too?
The sweater he was wearing?
The swagger. The way he carries himself. Yeah. There was a certain tone to Rahm Emanuel for a long time, and he doesn't seem to have it anymore. He just seems a lot... not like a beaten man, but a guy who's been challenged a time or two.
Yeah, but you know, he knows politics so well. This is the time for him to be quiet because he's really in a bad place. Yeah.
He is being quiet.
He's laying low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He has to do that.
But it's probably hard for him to do.
Rahm Emanuel's DNA is to be a tough, arrogant bully.
Sure.
No matter what he does, he still has that inside of him.
Right.
And there will be times when he's in trouble where he will soften up. I thought that's what you were talking about, the sweater he was wearing.
Oh, yeah, to soften up his
Remember when he ran for
re-election? Yes.
He wanted to look softer, so he wore a sweater?
Yeah.
The softer side of Rahm.
Yep.
So what's the sweater you mean?
No, the swagger. Just
swagger.
That's
like George Romney, right? The swagger. Oh, my God,
I still see his swagger. It's just we're not seeing as much of him,
right.
I think.
The swagger guy. Yeah. No. Yeah. You won't for a while.
Walter, your perspective can be found on WGNplus.com, and it's always entertaining, and it's great to see you. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you for having me.
This is the first time I've been on the air with you, and it's an honor, and you're a legend.
So if you have time, I'll come back. Love to.
That would be great.
In the building all the time.
You got it. It's Walter Jacobson, everybody.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break, and then more show coming your way next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
We're going to do a little baseball check. Oh, don't get me started.
What's
wrong? I'm a Sox fan. I hear that. I go crazy.
You get a little excited?
Don't stop believing, Bill.
You know who's with us, Wendy, is our friend Kevin Powell, the producer of the Steve Cochran Show and oftentimes sports aficionado. He is at spring training right now.
I met him in a smoky room.
Did you meet Kevin Powell
Smelled
in a smoky
the wine
room?
And cheap perfume.
That's crazy. Hi, Kevin.
That was a fun night, Wendy. I remember it vividly.
Yes.
Yeah, but I'm the one who's supposed to wear the cheap perfume, not you.
I always mix that up.
How are you guys doing? We're fine. We hope you're having a good time. This is a tough assignment. You were brave enough to fall on the sword for the sports department and head out to warmer
How'd
weather.
How'd you get this?
somebody had to head out to 85 in sunny Arizona, and I volunteered and stepped up to the plate for the team.
You're the best, Kevin. A lot of people wouldn't have done that. You're the only one who's brave enough to have done that. Had you been to spring training prior to the one you're at right now?
Yeah, a couple of years ago I was out here, and it's great. It's a great time. I wasn't exactly on the same assignment I'm on right now, actually covering both the teams. We went out a couple of years ago and just did a couple shows from Sloan Park where the Cubs play. And, so my second time out here.
So the situation is you take in a game maybe in the morning or in the afternoon, and the rest of the time, what do? Do you hang out with the players, with the fans? Who are you palling around with?
Well, the way it's worked in the past few days is there's always sort of a morning stretch, a morning practice at both camps every morning, and then there's about an hour break for the players, and then we walk over to the stadium, and then we watch the game. We get some sound from the players, maybe from the managers, either during or after. It's a little different than a regular season game. You actually get access to the players in the middle of a game. So if, let's say a John Lester makes a start and he finishes in the fourth inning, they call the media down in the fifth or sixth inning because those guys, the veterans, are just ready to get out of there.
Sure.
They're not going to sit around. They're not going to sit around for three or four more innings to watch, prospects trying to make the team.
Right. What has been the most pleasant experience so far of the spring training for you, Kevin?
Pleasant experience. I would just say the fact that I'm around Major League Baseball players.
Sure.
And I'm watching them play baseball, and it's really warm and sunny and beautiful out here.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah, it can't be.
What's wrong with that?
All right, so you were at White Sox camp all day today?
I was, and most of the day yesterday, and this is perfect timing because we actually have breaking White Sox news. I'm sure you guys heard yesterday. Adam Morosh told the team he plans to step away from the game. Didn't officially call it retirement, basically retirement.
He's suspending his campaign. Right?
Very, very, very timely, Bill. Yep.
Kevin's going to use that, on Roche Show later this afternoon.
Oh, come on.
That's phenomenal.
Right.
Anyways, we didn't know what the deal was. He's been dealing with some back issues throughout the spring. Anyways, today Kenny Williams just released a statement that said essentially he asked Adam LaRoche to dial it back when it comes to bringing his son Drake to the clubhouse every day. His son Drake is kind of a staple at the White Sox camp. He's there every day, kind of just hanging out with the players.
How old is he, Kevin?
15. And so it's
thinks that's so weird, and half of me is like, what's the big deal? He's old enough where he wouldn't get in anybody's way, or is he?
Right. Well, from what we've heard before, they said nothing but good things about him. I don't really think there's a bad guy in this situation. Kenny Williams is trying to win a championship, and he maybe had received word from players that they didn't like it. Maybe he did it. Maybe it was all Kenny Williams. And at the same time, Adam Morosh is 36, coming off one of the worst years statistically. So, for Adam Morosh, maybe that was just the end of the line for
him. The kid that broke the camel's back.
That's exactly what it is. That is
and
what
ironically,
it is.
Adam LaRoche, as a kid, spent a lot of time at the White Sox Park, Old Comiskey, because his dad,
Dave LaRoche,
was a coach with the team.
Yeah.
Kind of an interesting turn of events here. But
now his departure, though, Kevin, would leave a hole for the White Sox. They had counted on him as being a part-time DH, fill-in first baseman. What do they do to fill that gap?
Well, Robin Ventura said today he's even going to give a look at Matt Davidson, who's primarily a third baseman. He's a prospect for the White Sox, but he's been tearing it up this spring. He had two home runs yesterday, including a walk-off. Now, they could do some stuff in terms of the DH where they'd move some of the outfielders around, maybe Melky Cabrera play some DH. But I would be shocked if they didn't go get somebody outside the organization. Justin Moore knows out there. He's a career DH guy.
Yeah.
And then a trade would possibly be a stretch considering how thin their farm system is. But I'd be shocked if they don't make a move here within the next few days or even the next week.
Special surprise appearance at the good old White Sox camp in Arizona. Was it number 14?
It was. Paulie made a surprise appearance, talked with the club a little bit, and he met with us after and just kind of reflected on on his retirement. So he's playing a lot of hockey.
Really?
Yeah. And he says if the Hawks win it this year, he would be willing to call them the greatest team ever to win back-to-back Stanley Cups with their current roster. So
I don't think he'd be alone in calling them that.
No. And he also says he's been very busy, and I don't know if we have time for this cut, Kevin, but he did have kind of a funny line about being a full-time dad.
Let's hear it.
Kids. I mean, kids take up a lot of it. I mean, between all their activities and events, anybody with kids knows you kind of just feel like a taxi cab driver, driving everybody around, picking them up from school and taking them to school and practices and all that. But
so this just in, Paul Konerko is not retired anymore. He is coming back to work.
Yeah, he's going to be a cab driver. I got his number. When I'm bar hopping through Phoenix, I'm going to give him a call tonight to take me back to the hotel.
And then after he said that, Kevin, Drake LaRoche said, whatever. Did you hear that part? That was crazy.
Oh, this kid.
Yeah.
He tweeted about it. Yep. Yeah.
Oh, God. Well, have fun out there. Tell Paulie we love him, guys, and miss him.
I will, guys. Thanks for having me. I'll see you.
Absolutely. That's Kevin Powell, most notably of the Steve Cochran Show. But we all get to...
He's blossoming.
Yeah, he's blossoming right before our eyes, isn't he? We'll take a quick break. We'll find out what Ro and Anna have coming up next. It's Bill Leff and Wendy Snyder on WGN.